Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Welcome, Moors, to Moors Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana L. Bay. And this evening, my intentions and my goal is to set the record straight once and for all. We're going to be dealing with Moors and the rediscovering of self. Very, very important topic. We got some very, very informative information. But before we begin, let me state that the call-in number for this broadcast is 310-982-4184. You dial that number. If you want to speak to the host, you got a question or comment, go ahead and follow the prompts on your phone and raise your hand, and I'll get a signal here that you have something to say. We open up the lines and let you in. Now, also, we will be offering our free articles today, 14th Amendment Exposed, as well as the Commerce Game and How to Play, and Secrets of America. And the way you access that is just send me an email to Tahaka, send me those free articles. That's Tahaka53@hotmail.com, TAHAKA53@hotmail.com, and I will rush that over there to you. We have got some very, very important information in PDF, Word, and video format that we have placed into the archives for those who are dealing with law. We're going to be coming back later on in the week, probably first part of next week, maybe this week, and expound on that information so that we can be more effective at dealing with the mortgage companies, the banks, the sheriff's department when you're in court, and different things of that nature. And we're going to show you how to deal with your name, how to deal with your contracts, and how to put these things in place and how to enforce these documents, okay? So y'all make sure you stay tuned. Also, this Thursday night, we'll be dealing with part three of the Grand National Chairman, Elihu Pleasant Bay, will be with us, and he will be exposing more information, and his wives will actually be here in this third part so that they can tell their side of the story from when how they were affected by what was going on based on the information that was presented to you. The way to access Tahaka's archives is simply go to www.tahakaarchives.org. And once you get there, bookmark that thing and then call me at area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And I will help you with whatever it is that you got to, that you're trying to get to. Now, a lot of times I'd be busy because I got people calling me from all over the country and outside of the United States that are accessing the archives and are going to work and having successes all over the world. And so if I don't call you back right away, if I don't answer the phone right away, Go ahead and just sit tight. We'll get back with you. Okay? We will return your call. All right. Now, this evening is going to be a blast. We have what is it the Moors should rediscover about themselves? How can Moors use this discovery to benefit themselves today in America? What part of your ancient story is most important? What part does nationhood play in your discovery? How does the whole family benefit from this self-knowledge? These and many more questions are going to be answered here this evening. And I want to start out letting you know what my position is. It is my position that we are responsible for the main pillars of knowledge inside around the world, pretty much. I've done an extensive research. Matter of fact, I just gathered the remaining of my books from my library and put them out here, and I was amazed at some of the books that I've seen that I know I had read and the information contained in them, and trying to figure out a way to best present this information to you so that you will have access to the same knowledge. That is my primary objective. I can only use what tools are available to me. So therefore, what we have is what we're going to go ahead and expound on. And keep in mind that I'm encouraging you to listen to this broadcast over and over and over again. I would like to recommend some books for you to read. One of the books I want to recommend to you is a book called Stolen Legacy by George G. M. James. Another book is Nature Knows No Color Line by J. A. Rogers. Also, a good book to read is called Black Like Me by John Howard Griffin. That's a very, very enlightening book to read. Africa in History by Basil Davidson. The World's 16 Crucified Saviors by Kersey Graves. And there's another book called The Life You Were Born to Live by Dan Millman. Also, we want to get another book called The Serious Mystery. Now, this is by Temple. That's a very, very interesting book. And these are just some of the books that I wanted to bring to your attention. Civilization of Barbarism by Sheikh Anta Diop. That is a very powerful book. You want to add that to your library as well. When Rocks Cry Out by Horace Butler. Of Water and the Spirit by Maladoma Patrice Somme. Africa and Africans in the Making of the Atlantic World, 1400 to 1800, Thornton. Make sure that you write these books down so you can get it. Introduction to African Civilization by John G. Jackson. And then we have the works of John Henry Clark. You can just type his name in Amazon, and whatever comes up on John, just go ahead and get that. That's very, very important. And there are many, many more, and we'll be mentioning others later on in the broadcast. But for right now, I think that's enough. That should keep you busy for quite some time. But these are very, very important books, very powerful information. And they are actually a part of my personal library, and I wanted to share that with you so that you can get your copy. Keep in mind, these books are also labeled inside Tahaka's archives. You can go there inside the archives and read information that comes straight out of these books and much more information in regards to your history and our ancient story. Now, what I want to ask you to do, go ahead and buckle your seatbelt on this, because what we're going to do is we're going to start out setting the record straight once and for all. This is a permanent fixation. What I'm going to need you to do, those of you who are in college, If you're in high school, if you're in junior high school, it doesn't matter what school you're in inside the United States of America, go ahead and take this information, write this information down, and present it to your teacher and tell her you need him or her, you need them to expound on this information, okay, instead of the stuff that they've been giving you, because we're going to lay it out here this evening throughout the entire broadcast, okay? So sit tight.
Greetings.
Y'all hold your hat.
I am Anthony Stewart, and I will be reading to you The Stolen Legacy by Dr. George G.M. James. For the past 20 years, I have been a student of Black studies, especially in the area of history and religion. I have read over 200 or so books on the subject and have heard countless lectures, but none can ever really take the place of that first book, the first book that shines light into a darkness of a mind of ignorance. For me, that book was The Stolen Legacy by Dr. George G.M. James. A friend of mine allowed me to borrow and read the book back in the early 90s during a time of rebirth in Black consciousness. Public Enemy, The Teachings of the Nation of Islam, leather medallions with the symbol of Africa on them, and being seen with a Black history book was the trend in the African-American community. Not wanting to be left out, I asked for one of the many he had on his shelf. He suggested that I start with The Stolen Legacy. I asked him why that book, and he said, "When you don't know anything, any place is a good place to start." So I started, and I became hooked on the book's implication that all that I had thought to have been created by Europeans in the way of mathematics, arts and sciences, civics, theology, and more were actually created by Black Africans. Black people had created that which is the foundation of modern society. This was not the ravings of just an angry Black man trying to claim some type of glory from another just to boost his ego. Dr. George G.M. James had earned a Bachelor of Arts, Bachelor of Theology, and Master of Arts degrees from Durham University in England. He conducted research at London University and did postgraduate work at Columbia University, where he read for his Ph.D. Dr. James earned a teaching certificate in the state of New York to teach mathematics, Latin, and Greek. Dr. James later served as professor of logic and Greek at Livingston College in Salisbury, North Carolina, for 2 years, and eventually taught at the University of Arkansas, Pine Bluff. I would go on to absorb this book and materials which related to it, including a book titled Not Out of Africa, which was written 40 years after his book attempting to discredit the work in The Stolen Legacy. Though it received a great deal of praise in the white community, the only thing it succeeded in doing was proving Dr. James may have made some historical errors, but it did little to devalue the point that all the fame and glory given to the Greek philosophers Socrates, Plato, Pythagoras, Aristotle, and many more was misplaced, considering that what they had taught had already existed for thousands of years in Africa, that each of these so-called philosophers had studied in Africa early on, then return home to begin teaching what their people saw as foreign. So foreign that each major philosopher, including Aristotle, had to flee from their own lands for what they taught. Also, that the many conquerors that had taken over Egypt in particular for centuries to follow would consistently loot the temples and royal libraries and even kidnap the priests and scholars to extract their knowledge for their country's own growth. But I digress. I have converted this timeless classic into an audio format for your convenience, but also for the fact that Black people in America need to know what our ancestors have done. We must come to understand the depths of our heritage so that we can remove the dross of inferiority cultivated in us by a society which has usurped our rightful position. We must reclaim our stolen legacy. The aims of the book. The aim of the book is to establish better race relations in the world by revealing a fundamental truth concerning the contribution of the African continent to civilization. It must be borne in mind that the first lesson in the humanities is to make a people aware of their contributions to civilization. And the second lesson is to teach them about other civilizations. By this dissemination of the truth about the civilization of individual peoples, a better understanding among them and a proper appraisal of each other should follow. This notion is based upon the notion of the great mastermind. Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Consequently, the book is an attempt to show that the true authors of Greek philosophy were not the Greeks, but the people of North Africa, commonly called the Egyptians, and the praise and honor falsely given to the Greeks for centuries belonged to the people of North Africa, and therefore to the African continent. Consequently, this theft of the African legacy by the Greeks led to the erroneous world opinion that the African continent has made no contribution to civilization, and that its people are naturally backward. This is the misrepresentation that has become the basis of race prejudice, which has affected all people of color. For centuries, the world has been misled about the original source of the arts and sciences. For centuries, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle have been falsely idolized as models of intellectual greatness. And for centuries, the African continent has been called the Dark Continent, because Europe coveted the honor of transmitting to the world the arts and sciences. I am happy to be able to bring this information to the attention of the world, so that on one hand, all races and creeds might know the truth and free themselves from those prejudices which have corrupted human relations, and on the other hand, that the people of African origin might be emancipated from their serfdom of inferiority complex and enter upon a new era of freedom in which they would feel like free men with full human rights and privileges. The Stolen Legacy. Introduction. Characteristics of Greek philosophy. The term Greek philosophy, to begin with, is a misnomer, for there is no such philosophy in existence. The ancient Egyptians had developed a very complex religious system called the Mysteries, which was also the first system of salvation. As such, it regarded the human body as a prison house of the soul, which could be liberated from its bodily impediments through the disciplines of the arts and sciences, and advanced from the level of a mortal to that of a god. This was the notion of the summum bonum, or greatest good, to which all men must aspire, and it also became the basis of all ethical concepts. The Egyptian mystery system was also a secret order, and membership was gained by initiation and a pledge to secrecy. The teaching was graded and delivered orally to the neophyte, and under these circumstances of secrecy, the Egyptians developed secret systems of writing and teaching and forbade their initiates from writing what they had learned. After nearly 5,000 years of prohibition against the Greeks, they were permitted to enter Egypt for the purpose of their education, first through the Persian invasion, and secondly through the invasion of Alexander the Great. From the 6th century BC, therefore, to the death of Aristotle, 322 BC, the Greeks made the best of their chance to learn all they could about Egyptian culture. Most students received instructions directly from the Egyptian priests, but after the invasion by Alexander the Great, the royal temples and libraries were plundered and pillaged, and Aristotle's school converted the library at Alexandria into a research center. There is no wonder, then, that the production of the unusually large number of books ascribed to Aristotle has proved a physical impossibility for any single man within a lifetime. The history of Aristotle's life has done him far more harm than good, since it carefully avoids any statement relating to his visit to Egypt, either on his own account or in the company of Alexander the Great when he invaded Egypt. This silence of history at once throws doubt upon the life and achievements of Aristotle. He is said to have spent 20 years under the tutorship of Plato, who is regarded as a philosopher. Yet he graduated as the greatest of scientists of antiquity. Two questions might be asked. A. How could Plato teach Aristotle, which he himself did not know? B. Why should Aristotle spend 20 years under a teacher from whom he could learn nothing? This bit of history sounds incredible. Again, in order to avoid suspicion over the extraordinary number of books ascribed to Aristotle, history tells us that Alexander the Great gave him a large sum of money to get the books. Here again, the history sounds incredible, and three statements must here be made. A. In order to purchase books on science, they must have been in circulation so as to enable Aristotle to secure them. B. If the books were in circulation before Aristotle purchased them, and since he is not supposed to have visited Egypt at all, then the books in question must have been circulated among Greek philosophers. C. If circulated among Greek philosophers, then we would expect the subject matter of such books to have been known before Aristotle's time, and consequently, he could not be credited either with producing them or introducing new ideas of science. Another point of considerable interest to be accounted for was the attitude of the Athenian government towards this so-called Greek philosophy, which it regarded as foreign in origin and treated it accordingly. Only a brief study of history is necessary to show that Greek philosophers were undesirable citizens who, throughout the period of their investigations, were victims of relentless persecution at the hands of the Athenian government. Anaxagoras was imprisoned in exile, Socrates was executed, Plato was sold into slavery, and Aristotle was indicted and exiled, while the earliest of them all, Pythagoras, was expelled from Croton in Italy. Can we imagine the Greeks making such an about turn as to claim the very teachings which they had at first persecuted and openly rejected? Certainly they knew they were usurping what they had never produced. And as we enter step by step into our study, the greater do we discover evidence which leads us to the conclusion that Greek philosophers were not the authors of Greek philosophy, but the Egyptian priests and hierophants. Aristotle died in 322 BC, not many years after he had been aided by Alexander the Great to secure the largest quantity of scientific books from the royal libraries and temples of Egypt. In spite, however, of such great intellectual treasure, the death of Aristotle marked the death of philosophy among the Greeks, who did not seem to possess the natural ability to advance these sciences. Consequently, history informs us that the Greeks were forced to make a study of ethics, which they also borrowed from the Egyptian summum bonum, or greatest good. The two other Athenian philosophers must be mentioned here. I mean Socrates and Plato, who also became famous in history as philosophers and great thinkers. Every schoolboy believes that when he hears or reads the command, "Know thyself," he is hearing or reading words which were uttered by Socrates. But the truth is that the Egyptian temples carried inscriptions on the outside addressed to the neophytes, and among them was the injunction, "Know thyself." Socrates copied these words from the Egyptian temples and was not the author. All mystery temples, inside and outside of Egypt, carried such inscriptions, just like the weekly bulletins of our modern churches. Similarly, every schoolboy believes that when he hears or reads the names of the four cardinal virtues, he is hearing or reading names of virtues determined by Plato. Nothing has been more misleading, for the Egyptian mystery system contained 10 virtues, and from this source, Plato copied what have been called the four cardinal virtues: justice, wisdom, temperance, and courage. It is indeed surprising how, for centuries, the Greeks have been praised by the Western world for intellectual accomplishments which belong without a doubt to the Egyptians or the peoples of North Africa. Another notable characteristic of Greek philosophy is the fact that most of the Greek philosophers used the teachings of Pythagoras as their model, and consequently they have introduced nothing new in the field of philosophy. Included in the Pythagorean system, we find the doctrines of A, opposites, B, harmony, C, fire, D, mind, since it is composed of fire atoms, E, immortality, expressed as the transmigration of souls, F, the summum bonum, or the purpose of philosophy. And these, of course, are reflected in the systems of Heraclitus, Parmenides, Democritus, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. The next thing that is peculiar about Greek philosophy is its use in literature. The Egyptian mystery system was the first secret order of history, and the publication of its teachings was strictly prohibited. This explains why initiates like Socrates did not commit to writing their philosophy, and why the Babylonians and Chaldeans, who were very closely associated with them, also refrained from publishing those teachings. We can at once see how easy it was for an ambitious and even envious nation to claim a body of unwritten knowledge which would make them great in the eyes of the primitive world. The absurdity, however, is easily recognized when we remember that the Greek language was used to translate several systems of teachings which the Greeks could not succeed in claiming. Such were the translation of Hebrew scriptures into Greek, called the Septuagint, and the translation of the Christian Gospels, Acts, and the Epistles into Greek, still called the Greek New Testament. It is only the unwritten philosophy of the Egyptians, translated into Greek, that has met with such an unhappy fate, a legacy stolen by the Greeks. On account of reasons already given, I have been compelled to handle the subject matter of this book in a way it has been handled, namely, A, with the frequency of repetition, because it is the method of Greek philosophy to use a common principle to explain several different doctrines, and B, the quotation and analysis of doctrines, because it is the object of this book to establish the Egyptian origin, and this cannot be so satisfactorily done if the doctrines are not presented. Greek philosophy is somewhat of a drama, whose chief actors were Alexander the Great, Aristotle, and his successors in the Peripatetic school, and the Roman Emperor Justinian. Alexander invaded Egypt and captured the royal library at Alexandria and plundered it. Aristotle made a library of his own with plundered books, while his school occupied the building and used it as a research center. Finally, Justinian, the Roman Emperor, abolished the temples and schools of philosophy, i.e., another name for the Egyptian mysteries, which the Greeks claimed as their product, and on account of which they have been falsely praised and honored for centuries by the world, as its greatest philosophers and thinkers. This contribution to civilization was really and truly made by the Egyptians and the African continent, but not by the Greeks or the European continent. We sometimes wonder why the people of African descent find themselves in such social plight as they do, but the answer is plain enough. Had it not been for this drama of Greek philosophy and its actors, the African continent would have had a different reputation, and would have enjoyed a status of respect among the nations of the world. This unfortunate position in the African continent and its peoples appears to be the result of misrepresentation upon which the structure of race prejudice has been built, i.e. the historical world opinion that the African continent is backward, that its people are backward, and that their civilization is also backward. Finally, the dishonesty in the movement of the publication of a Greek philosophy becomes very glaring when we refer to the fact, purposely, that by calling the theorem of the square on the hypotenuse the Pythagorean theorem, it has concealed the truth for centuries from the world, who ought to know that the Egyptians taught Pythagoras and the Greeks what mathematics they knew. I want to mention here that among the many books which I found helpful in my present work are The Intellectual Adventure of Man and The Egyptian Religion by Professor Henri Frankfurt and The Mediterranean World in Ancient Times by Professor Eva Sanford. George Jim James.
Okay. Moses, this is the shot that we can hear from around the entire world. Go inside your schools. Ask your college professors about this. Bring this. You can go right there on my Morris Talk Live 100 page, and you can actually download it and upload this broadcast to a disc. You had to put it in condensed form, and then that way you can give it to them to listen to at their leisure and come inside the classroom and let you know what they think about that. So my question now is this. How is it humanly possible for anybody to come to you and tell you anything about Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, any of them bringing anything to the table because they brought absolutely nothing to the table, period? You walk into a doctor's office, you look up over his office door, and you see what's called the supposed to be the father of medicine, Hippocrates. Do an investigation on it and see what you find. Okay. What did it bring to the table? Go into Stanley Lane Pool, the Moors in Spain. And in there, he will plainly tell you that the Moors ruled Spain for 780 years, as early as the 10th century. They built paved sidewalks, installed street lamps, built 200 public baths so any man can walk on off the street and take a bath. That's a mark of civilization for real. Then we got houses, and temples, and libraries, one of which housed over 10,000 manuscripts. They invited the European monks in to look around to get their opinion on what they were seeing, and the monks were shocked because they didn't have any of this in Europe. So I'm trying to understand now, how is it that we are supposed to be trying to seek after these colleges and universities and stuff to get some education when there is none that they can give you that they didn't steal from you? You understand? What we're doing here this evening is we're just getting started on setting the record straight. Now, at this point, if there's anybody that got a question or comment, go ahead and raise your hand. I'll open up the line, and you can tell me what you think about it. But in the meantime, we're going to move on into expounding this information because we just got started, but I just wanted to fire the first shot to go all the way around the world so you can know exactly what happened. We want to specify it definitely so there will be no misunderstanding about what's going on inside our colleges and universities, because knowledge is power. But now, if we're getting a watered-down version of what we are calling knowledge, then we're not getting anything at all. Not one single thing are we getting, period. So it behooves us to sit tight here this evening, and we're going to bring this stuff here to you, okay? Now, once again, those of you who are on your social sites, if you're on your social sites, go ahead and send a friend request to Tahaka Amana L. Bay, and I will grant that, because they keep me blocked, and as a result of what you just heard, I guess you can pretty much understand why, because I like to deal with the truth, and I like to deal with solutions to the problem. So the hospitals across the country, they treat illnesses, but when you go in the hospital and you're in pain, you want a cure. You don't want to be treated, you want a cure. But they're not in the curing business, because there's no money there. Okay?
White Americans have a criminal history. They have a criminal nation. The nation is built on criminality and murder and exploitation. It is a part of their collective psyche. The United States is a mafia government. No one has done more damage and degradation and murder, rape, and robbery than Europeans. Yes. Therefore, in order to escape confrontation with their true criminal nature, they must accuse others of being criminals. What we call projection. They must become obsessed with the criminality of other people. And black folk become those other people, you see. As Ken, like say, Clinton Cox say, you call the Indians savages so you can behave toward them what? Savagely. That's the function of stereotyping, you see. If I call you a criminal, then I can treat you what? Criminally. I don't owe you justice. In fact, shooting you in the street is justice. We know you are already a criminal. Why should we bother to take you to trial? Yes, that's what it is. We're doing a service. We're saving the taxpayers money. What have we lost? A criminal? Why are you complaining about? Yeah, this is the deal. What does it mean then? When you can become, then often people, in order to escape certain problems, become obsessed with other issues to the point where they don't have time or the energy or anything else to think about anything else. They don't see anything else. So I can forget myself hatred. I can forget myself alienation if I concentrate on how much I love myself. But this is a bad kind of love, you see. It's not the right kind of love. If I concentrate on what? How great I am. If I concentrate on making other people see what? How great I am. You see? And therefore, my 24 hours a day, I'm obsessed by projecting my what? Greatness. And I will, but that greatness is coming out of what? Hatred and inferiority. And since I'm greater than everyone else, I must make everyone else superior, in what? Inferior to me. In fact, I can only love people who attest to my superiority. I can only love a woman who 24 hours a day maintains my superior ego and states that she is in need of leadership and guidance. And I'm her leader. I may be emasculated in the world, but in my house, I'm the king. And at any moment she indicates that I have feet of clay, I shall use them to stomp her. Yeah. This is the kind of thing we have here. Yeah, and it goes the other way, too. You know, make me a goddess and lay at my feet all kinds of sacrifices. Yeah, yeah. Live through me. And any moment that you don't hold this up, I'm going to react with anger and call you all kinds of names and problems. That's the issue of narcissism. Then you have the phallic the phallic character, flaunts his masculinity through success at work or conquest over women, constantly seeking confirmation of his potency, identifies himself with his penis. Ultimately, though, ladies and gentlemen, this is a man who's afraid of castration, who really thinks his balls have already been cut out from under him. Therefore, he needs a constant confirmation that he has them. Kind of reminds me again of the black and white video. What was that boy trying to grab down in between his legs? What are so many black men grabbing at all the time out there? Yes, it's seeing if it's there. Yes, where is it? In other words, then, that relationship can move into a master-slave kind of relationship, a relationship that tries to use and exploit other people, a relationship that, in a sense, duplicates the social relationship that the man has. Don't worry about it. It'll be all right. At the end, you have people then who have a problem with lovability and are in constant need of reassurance. So what does this all imply? We don't have time to go into it all. What does it all imply? What does it roll out to be? It means then that if we are to transform the relationship between black males and black females and transform the nature of black life, period, we must transform the American system itself. Yeah, we can't get around that. Oh, yeah, we have to if we are going to say that living in America, being black in America, creates a good deal of the problems that we have, then we must change America as a part of changing what? The problems. Now, it doesn't mean that we focus outside of ourselves, because one of the best ways of changing America is by what means? Changing ourselves. I've told you before that we are not only the creation of whites, we also create them. That they cannot be what they are unless we are what we are. And therefore, if we engage in self-transformation, we engage in the transformation of the nation, and ultimately in the transformation of the world. This is what I'm saying again about an African-centered education, that more deeply than all, in terms of an African-centric education, is that we are not creating a revolution in America as much as we are creating a revolution in ourselves. But that revolution in ourselves is a revolution in America. And that's why we look at ourselves and transform ourselves. It means then that we must gain a perception of what is real. Maladaptive behaviors flow from the inability to operate in terms of what is real in the world. Where are we as African people? What is our real history? What is the real nature of this social system? And how does that reality intrude into our lives? We must come to know ourselves. If we do not know ourselves, we lose control of ourselves. We don't know why and for what reason we behave as we do. We must exercise control over ourselves. We must come to esteem ourselves and accept ourselves. To a good extent, the problems that we talk about all the time are problems that flow from people avoiding themselves, escaping their real selves, and creating mechanisms and machinations to facilitate their escape from themselves, and using other people and abusing other people in their escape from self-acceptance, in their escape from their real African selves as a people. And therefore, if we're going to stop abusing and using other people and using them as objects and so forth, then we must come back into self-acceptance and come back into reality. We must gain the ability to form affectionate relationships. And ladies and gentlemen, the ability to love and how to love is taught. In this system, we are taught that it's something that occurs accidentally and spontaneously. That is not true. Even romantic love with all of its shivers up and down your spine. And all of this business about you can't eat and you can't sleep and, you know, you toss and turn all night.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to say I consider myself quite fortunate enough to be guided into the study of self and realizing how important it was for me personally to embrace knowledge about my own self. It has been one of the most powerful tools that I've had in my possession, and it is caused, you can, it's difficult for me to describe to you to have this kind of power in your brain where it just flows out automatically anytime some diffusion of truth comes up or someone attempts to exert themselves who you know don't have no power, where you can quietly and gently expose them to the truth and back up and watch the respect you have. Nobody on this planet can respect you until you respect yourself first. And the way you get that respect is you have to empower yourself. You have to guard your brain and make sure that when you are in a setting with anyone, you are dealing from your position, armed with all the accoutrements that in your particular case, a person of African descent cannot be denied and cannot be refuted. And that the greatest and most magnificent set of circumstances is attached to you with evidence that they still trying to figure out to this day. So there's no need for you to divest yourself of who you are. That should always come to the forefront in dealing with
all that's taught. You've been listening to the music all the time, haven't you? It's told you how you should feel when you're in love. You know, right? Isn't that what it says? Oh, I think about him all the time. I can't sleep. I can't. Oh, you're in love. Not necessarily. You may be addicted. Pun unintended. You may be addicted in the sense that you are using this person, this relationship, to escape your reality, to get away from yourself. You see? And to the degree that they can be used for you to escape who you are and what you are, to that degree you feel good in their presence. You feel euphoric. You can't live without them, because without them you go into withdrawal. You see? And you begin to face the craziness of your condition. And you begin to face the real pain that is at the root of your escape in the first place. And you can't cold turkey and live through it and come to know what's really behind it, you see. So you reach out again for another rush, for another person, and promiscuity increases, infidelity increases, and even when you're married, you're still showing your butt and carrying on as if you're not married, you see. And you can't rest. You need the admiration of men and the admiration of women. Still, you know, it just goes on and it's endless. They can't be good enough for you. You seek perfection. You seek excitement, because that's in excitement you forget about reality. And you have good men. I run into too many good men out here. Educated men, good salaries, loyal men. I'm telling you, who are being rejected by women black women. Don't make this game appear that it's only black men who are rejecting black women. There are many women out there. They want this perfect person.
Yes, sir.
You see, this exciting person, this black white man. You see. And a good black man is too boring and uninspiring. Or else you say, well, let me keep you out there for a while and I'll come back for you later. You know, this kind of thing. And it goes what? The other way. So we must learn that love is taught. Children are taught to love. That's another thing that African-centered education teaches, you see. Love and affection. That's another reason why we want to take these young men to the sun. How do you love a woman? What is real love? What is the difference between real love and addiction and the real love and use and abuse of a woman, you see? How do you love yourself first so that you don't use a woman to support your own missed and perceived self as a person, you see? And often it's difficult sometimes unless you can get them by themselves because, see, in the middle of women, often they got to show off a bit.
Right.
They can't come to terms with themselves, you see? And sometimes you got to take them out there and see what it is. What is this game called America? What is this game called love anyway? Where did you get that word from? How did love develop? What is the history of love? Do you know there's a history to love? That Europeans were taught love, and love was defined and written in books, and ultimately taught by the ruling classes to the lower classes. And then it became a basis for marriage and the whole thing. Let's examine this before we talk about how much we love and don't love each other. What is this thing called love anyway? Where does it come from? Why is this essence that says it's irrational? You know, we got to look at that. But most of all, ladies and gentlemen, we've got to reclaim our African identity and our African selves, and we've got to free our African mind. Thank you very much.
Hold on, brothers and sisters. I see everybody thoroughly enjoyed the lecture, so you have something to work with when you get by the water cooler this week. Now,
one does not gain spiritual clarity or deep spiritual understanding without self-knowledge. As a matter of fact, the route to healthy spirituality is through self-knowledge. Because ultimately, you see, even though we put the emphasis on self, as I said earlier, that in getting to know who we are as a self ultimately means getting to know how our self came into being, which means that a deep sense of self-knowledge means getting to know the world and the principles by which self is created, which, of course, then brings us into an examination of those who are our creators and those people who we interacted with, the nature of the world that we live in. And ultimately, to get to know ourselves, we, in a sense, have to even step outside of ourselves at that point and enter into another consciousness. And to me, that entering into that consciousness becomes a cosmic consciousness, you see, where we see the self not as separated from the world, not as individually demarcated from the world, but as a part of the total cosmic atmosphere, as a part of the great oneness with the Spirit or with God, if you will. I do not believe that people who are engaged in self-hatred and who are separated from themselves and who have not truly come to know themselves can truly come to know God. They will be sold things. You saw that thing here the other night on, was it Prime Time? Where the preachers were rooking these people off. Some of them getting much as, what, $1 million or more a day. Millions and millions of dollars. People who are being deceived by the Jimmy Swaggerts and the other people of the world, and yet they're being deceived in terms of their spirituality. But one, to me, of the hallmarks of spirituality is enlightenment and clarity and the ability to discern reality and to look through a good deal of chicanery. You see? And to me, to be taken again and again and again and to be misused in the name of religion means that one needs to reexamine what that religion and spirituality is about. This too often is sold to African American people purely as a feeling, you see, and some kind of body feeling, and it's measured. And you know, I've told you before that you can't equate good feelings and even unusual feelings with necessarily being possessed by God. You can confuse those two things. In fact, the devil will trick you by representing himself as what? God, you see. And I've also mentioned to you before here to remember one thing, that Africans did not come to this country as Christians. Now, that hurts a lot of people's feelings. But you must understand that Africans did not come to this country as Christians. It's very important to understand that. Where did Africans learn, particularly African-American, this Christianity from? Even if you said you found it, the kind you learned is still not what you found it. Yeah. Where did you learn it from? Who taught it to you? And for what reason did they teach it to you? You got to keep that in mind. Even though you may be sincere in your worship of Christ, and no one questions that, and no one questions Christ. All right, I want you to understand this. That does not mean, though, that your sincerity cannot be used as a base to manipulate you against yourself and to manipulate you against your people. You're still obligated to know self and to understand self and to know the world and to understand the world as a part of your spiritual development. You understand? And therefore, we have too many people who are caught up in the church, who still divorce, who still fight, who still do all the other things that we talk about here. When I look at the Anita Hill and what's her name? Judge Thomas deal, here you have a misplaced morality going on there. But to me, it's the epitome of the way white folk want morality to work among black folk. Her concern with morality, ultimately working itself away in a way that it still maintains the system and maintains dissension within her ethnic group, which is the reason why it was taught, by the way. Now let's look at the other end that you're speaking of here. The second part having to deal, it was in my mind just that fast. It went down. The other thing is, when you're separated from yourself, you're separated from your real self. You're separated from your potential. And there's a vacuum created, and there's also a pain created as well. A vague feeling of discomfort and dis-ease that's extremely discomforting. The individual then must relieve this pain and must relieve this emptiness that has occurred as a result of being separated from who he or she really is. The individual asks who he or she really is and somehow must arrive at an answer. When other people who rob you and separate you from yourself, and this is the essence of brainwashing, you see, to separate the individual from his identity, to make him uncomfortable, to make him confused, to make him suffer pain, and say, now, if you think about yourself this way, if you see yourself this way, this is, if you assume that this is who you are, you will come together again, and you will be healed, or you will be at one with yourself. In this way, then, a false and artificial identity is placed within the person. And the person will often identify with that input or that false interjected soul. And because it brings them a certain amount of comfort, or because they see it as protecting them against destruction or annihilation and so forth, they will cling to it and see it as a part of themselves. And in this sense, then, blacks have been made to think to a good extent that by escaping their African self and trying to deny their color and trying to escape African culture and so forth, we have opened ourselves up to being implanted with a white demon. And it is that white demon in us that manipulates our bodies and manipulates our minds. It is one of the reasons why we lose self-control. We say things that we know we shouldn't be saying, but we can't what? Help ourselves. We eat things that we know we shouldn't be what? Eating, but the appetite is out of control, you see. And if you look at what you say, if you look at what you eat, if you look at what you desire, you will see all those things that you eat, that you desire, that you want, are things that maintain and enrich white folk. It means then that the demon that's implanted in the place of the real African self is a demon that works for its creator, you see, and it works to maintain its creator in a place of domination. That is why the process of reclaiming our African selves and coming back to ourselves is a process of exorcising devils. And that is the reason why a reclamation of ourselves is a reclamation of health, a reclamation of self-control, and a reclamation of love, and a reclamation of positive relations between black men and black women and between ourselves and the world. Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am. And it cries out for social transformation in our community as well, because that disease, it startles my class often when I tell people, you must recognize that disease is not only a biological entity, but it is also a sociological entity. It is a political entity. These diseases and the way they operate in the world also reflect political formations or the absence of political formations, you see. And it implies a social structure. So if you got a social structure caught up with drugs and other kinds of things, you will see that disease visiting this kind of social structure in a way that it would not in another social structure and cultural structure. So in the end, again, these things cry out for a transformation of African culture as we see it, in African-American culture as we see it today, and it cries out for a transformation of political structures as well as economic structures in the black community. Mm-hmm.
One more question.
Okay. Yes, I do, buddy. Mm-hmm.
You spoke earlier about the confusion that the multicultural curriculum is going to cause in our community.
Excuse me, brother. Can you speak a little louder, please?
You spoke earlier about the confusion that the multicultural curriculum is going to cause in our community. Should we have an expectation that the public school system or the school system that we're sending our kids through is going to prepare them or educate them in order to take their dominant position?
Certainly, you know, Diane Ravitch, we're all familiar with Diane, of course. Diane Ravitch, though, is an avowed multiculturalist. And, in fact, when Jeffries reviewed, if you look at the Jeffries statement, he's reviewing already a multicultural curriculum. It is the comments of Jeffries about its inadequacies and so forth that is the issue more than the idea that he's creating one or promoting one and so forth. So in a sense, New York State had already began the process on a certain level, an inadequate one, but the idea of a so-called multicultural curriculum was already there. And in a sense, the evaluation that Jeffries did along with the others was really an evaluation in terms of the inadequacy of that pre-existing curriculum, not a desire to just necessarily bring it into being, but saying, you've tried, but it's inadequate, your books are inadequate, this, you know, this and so forth is inadequate. What am I saying here then? I say that we forget one fundamental rule, and I may be two, and that is one thing, that whites never intend to turn black folk loose from the subordinate position. You can dream and wish all you want to, and you can get caught up in all this craziness that these white folk one day are going to hand this world over to you and let you operate as equal to them. You got to be out of your mind to believe that. As Bell LaFrere says, the idea that the oppressor, because let me tell you, at the point that whites do not need us, they are going to rid themselves of us. And their need is one of subordination. There's every intention by this society to maintain the subordination of black people till time ends, or if they no longer need black people, to destroy black people. The Indian is a prime example of that. The Indian was destroyed because the Indian was of no economic value to white folk. You know, and I say that because a lot of us think we're just here because we prayed hard to Jesus. I'm telling you, we're here too because we're of economic value. The white man didn't ship us over here just to kill us, you know. We had economic value for this man. And now, when it gets to the point where our value is greatly decreased, and it's already beginning to occur, you're dealing with what? QEA, is that what they call it? Quality Education Act. What these white folk are saying here in New Jersey is that you are not worth the investment. Now, they don't need to invest in black schools. They are hiring people. I've told some group here about McGraw-Hill in Hillsdale, New Jersey, that has all of its circulation work being done in Ireland. It's the computers and stuff that do the work about the circulation of some 16 magazines is being done in Ireland on computers, and the information is sent directly to the mainframe here. They do not have to hire in New Jersey to get people to input computerized information. They are, and this is a trend that's rapidly developing. They hire people in the Philippines and so forth. The idea is now that they can hire from around the world and they can import into this country what they need. They import now close to 1 million people a year to fill in the gaps that they need in this system. And now the idea that they're going to invest money into black people whom they've convinced cannot learn is one you better wake up to, and it's occurring right in front of your face, right here. You understand? So what am I saying here then? The idea then that we are going to be able to give our children the kind of education they need in the public schools is one that we have to disabuse ourselves of. However, I do advocate going for the whole machinery, you know. That's right. That's no reason what to back off of it, you see. But to go for as much of it as you can get. Because ultimately, we should be going for the control of this nation. Yeah, yeah. A part of the African-centered education is an education into how we can get so much control and influence in this nation until we can make an African-centered education occur in the public schools. Understand? Is that too much? I get this little thing here. You know. Now, we do realize that the true African-centered education under these conditions require that the most essential portions of that education takes place outside of the public schools. What I'm warning against in particular is this idea that we think that multicultural education in the school removes our responsibility for engaging in the kind of things we're engaging here today. We no longer have to teach our children. What we really need to teach them we cannot put into public schools, and we should not put into public schools. That's one of the reasons why I talk about economics at the same time I talk about education. Because what I'm saying is we need the money that we are giving to other people to construct and finance schools so that after our children leave these multicultural public schools, we can teach them in after-school programs, weekend programs, summer school programs, and even some private school programs that give a full education to be fully African-centered. So it becomes a matter of being flexible in using both the public schools, private schools, and cultural institutions more than anything else. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for your time. Oh, okay.
One more, this sister over here. She's a teacher in whatever we call it. She's part of it.
Mm-hmm. I'm not a teacher, I'm a parent. Okay. Uh-huh. A very active parent. And, I want to ask you a question still relating to public school education. We know how to feel about it.
Yes.
With the board members that we have on that are currently on the board, these folks have sold our children down the drain. Okay. How can we, as parents and as community, hold these people accountable to the education of our children, whether we voted for them or not? You know, because what is happening right now with the board of the Milk Board of Education is that folks are not reading the writings on the wall. They still think that they can continue to miseducate our children. They still feel that they do not have to suffer any consequences. And in addition to the Quality Education Act, what is happening right now, I don't know if anyone read the newspaper today, what is happening is that you have two Republican senators who are totally against equal spending for our children in the 30 urban districts, and these folks intend not to give the money to our district. Now, I have a problem with board members who, when they are the administration general, who, when they get the money is not spent on our children. So I can understand why folks don't want to give us money.
Yeah.
But how can we hold these people who are down there accountable to the education of our children?
So that's, of course, a multi-layered problem and a very important one. I think we have to look at a number of things. We have to ask the question too: to what extent are these people even capable, even with good intentions, of providing an appropriate education for our children? An African-centered education, you see, I keep coming back to this, because one of the things that an African-centered education recognizes is the effects that history has had on the psychology of African people. And when I say the psychology of African people, I'm saying that when you play certain roles in a society, well, let me give you an example. I was telling my students the other evening, when, for instance, job discrimination occurs, you not only prevent a certain person from earning the salary that job represents or attaining the social status that a job represents, in the long run, you really rob them of certain thinking and behavioral skills, because each occupational level carries with it certain thought patterns and patterns of perception, language usage, and other kinds of things, you see. And therefore, when you lock people out of certain roles and positions and functions in a society, you, in effect, rob them of certain intellectual capacities and abilities. So job discrimination is not only a mere act of economic discrimination, but it is really an act of creating a particular kind of thought pattern, a cognitive pattern, motivational pattern in a people. So that in maintaining black people in roles that deal with concrete activities, secondary activities, roles that essentially servile in their nature, means that there is a mentality and a thought style that goes with this role. It means then that we inadvertently and unconsciously pass on this style to our children, which is another way the black family, as I talked about earlier, serves as an agent to maintain its own children in the same position. That is why a poor family, a mother, a father, has to be very conscious when they want to move their children out of prison. I'm going to get back to your question in a minute, but I just want to preface something here for a second. That's why you have to be conscious to get your children out of certain things, because unconsciously you can just pass on already what you have. Now, what am I saying then? There are certain styles of thinking that many of our children have, certain motivational orientations that come both from the African world and were accentuated in here in America. There are certain time systems that we need to be instilled that we have not studied, we do not know. And consequently, often many people with even good intentions still will produce an inadequate educational structure. So number one, we need to educate our board members and insist. Yeah, and insist. I don't know whether they could do it if they had good intentions. I don't know whether they can know what a good intention is because they have no knowledge of self. You see, and you can only judge an intention in terms of where it comes from and in terms of knowing yourself. So, you see, the thing is, in the other systems, we as black people have not yet decided that we would take over the certification function so that we make sure people know enough and know enough self to be in them. The other deal is, then, that board needs to be educated. When you ask that question, what can we do? I don't know how many people can do it, but I say one thing. And this is the kind of issue we'll be discussing in our sessions. What is the role of terrorism within one's own community? In other words, the terrorist is not there to necessarily always work on the outside. The terrorist also is there to control what goes on the inside. To what degree are we, as African people, willing to build an instrument of punishment within the black community? Yeah, and that's the reality. The reason why these people do what they do is that they don't figure, and they fear they can hide behind these white men and these white policemen, and that you can't get to them. And the other reason is that we are law-abiding, and we are afraid to go outside the law. We talk about revolution, but we want legal revolution. There's no such thing as legal revolution. We have to do what other people do, and that is we got to show them in some form or another that they will suffer as a result of going against us. And we got to know another thing. When you are poor, when we are poor as black people, you usually have only one weapon left. After you get through negotiating, you get through protesting, you get through pleading, and that is the weapon of disruption. Tearing up the system so it will not function. That's it. We have to use that weapon. That is why now people want to lay this racial harmony on us. And they want to lay this moral game on us. Because when you fill the poor with high morality and, you know, and all this high racial harmony stuff, it will refuse to use the only weapon it has, and that weapon is to disrupt and destroy. And unless this community is ready to disrupt and is ready to be threatening and painful to those people, then, of course, we are just going to complain. Young girl, you're going to take them through the rituals and everything, but they're going to still have European taste and Europe and desire European things, and they still pursue European ideals and all that, even with their kente on. And despite then and their superficial behavior, if those tastes and interests and passions and so forth are not also transformed in particular directions, despite their superficial attachment to African culture, they will continue to perpetuate their oppression and maintain the system that they think they're trying to get out from, you see? And this is why you have to understand this theoretical thing, so that you know where you're going when you're talking about educating these children African-centrically, you see. This is why you ultimately are going to have to reject multiculturalism and understand that it's African-centeredness that must be taught to our children, not multiculturalism. Multiculturalism says, all right, everybody's cultures, okay, you know, Pollyanna. Oh, you got a culture, I got a culture, all God's children got a culture. So, you know, So, you know, it's all right, you can taste from this one, you can taste from that one, you buy from this one, you buy from that one, which is exactly what black folk are doing right now. You see? And therefore what? Keeping other people's families alive, keeping them out of crime, keeping them well housed, you know, and all the things we're doing because we have not controlled our what? Taste and interest and evolved them in ways that they advance our culture and us as a people. Please get rid of multiculturalism. And it makes you believe every culture is all right. Here you are suffering from European culture, and now you're going to, you know, it's all right. You can't put one down to put the other one up. I mean, Europeans amuse me anyway, talking about their cultural traditions and what great traditions they have brought to the world. The tradition is what you do. Yeah. And it's an insult as an African man to have Europeans talk about their great tradition.
That's right.
You may talk about your philosophy, but that's not your tradition. You may talk about your religion, but that's not your tradition. Or if it is your tradition, then no matter how beautiful it sounds, I must reject it. Because it enslaved me. It oppressed me. And the whole bit, you see. So, and I don't care how sweet it sounds and how logically it is put together or how literate it may be. The ultimate thing is, in what way does it express itself in relationship to me and my people? And if this is the outcome of European tradition, then that tradition must be rejected. You must understand, ladies and gentlemen, what Europeans call great tradition goes hand in hand with their capacity to kill. You know, the Germans, I couldn't understand. You know, we were the literary people and we were the, you know, this and that. But that's one of the reasons why you were able to kill the way you did, because that was also in there as well. You look at Elijah Muhammad, a misunderstood person. Yeah, misunderstood. Because again, sometimes we're so right-brained, we let our dislike or disapproval of certain of his behaviors overshadow our capacity to see what gifts he brought us as a people and to come to really understand what this man was about and the greatness of what he created in the Nation of Islam. Yeah. Because we let a series of events get to us so much, we want to throw the baby out with the washwater. You see. But what was he doing? He recognized, too, that cultural identity, religious identity, were as political as they were psychological, were as economical as they were psychological. You see. And he recognized then that he had to also change the taste of black people and change their what? Interest as well. Their emotions and their what? Feelings as well. And a part of that change was projection of the white man is demon mythology, which was very functional and real. But very functional. See, I've told you a lot of people think, oh, well, that wasn't the truth. This wasn't the point. It wasn't the point. It amazes me now. You know, someone mentioned the Tuskegee experiments. These whites are going to tell all the truth now that they got the what? The world, what? Wrapped up. But in wrapping it up, they projected the what? The myth. Because the myth, the major function of the myth is to organize people, to organize a people's perception of themselves, to give them a sense of destiny and commonality, to arrange their social relations in such a way so that they could achieve particular points and particular ends. And it's not that they didn't know that the Egyptians might have been African. It was in their literature. That's a lot of where we got it from, isn't it? But at the point where a mythology of Africans as being uncultured served to organize them and create a unity among themselves and served to create a set of relations that permitted them to make a conquest of the globe, they projected that mythology. And it was a powerful one. Now that they think they have it made, they say, well, yeah, you were Egyptians, weren't you? Oh, yeah, we did give you TB down there. You know, what are you going to do about it? Oh, now we're becoming honest folk. You know, but what happened? No banks are changing hands. No means and ownership of production are changing hands. No real control of your destiny is changing hands. But you're multicultural now. We have greater understanding and truth. Mm-mm. Got to go deeper than that. You got to do more than tell the truth. You're going to reparate yourself. We're going to take these reparations from you. You can admit we're Egyptians if you want to, but it's not the end of it. Mm-mm. No way. And we as black people can't fall for the okie doke. Oh, they say we're Egyptian. Ain't that wonderful? Oh, they're saying that we're this and we're that. Isn't that nice? Uh-uh. Now, you see, because now we're moving toward multiculturalism, right? Suddenly we're going to see them all as nice and sweet and wonderful. But what? The actual power relations that run the world will do what? Be exactly what? The same. As a matter of fact, we will even support them now because we feel so good about ourselves. Elijah Muhammad then.
Okay, Moses, we're back. Now, if anybody got any questions, if you have a comment, now's the time to raise your hand, and we will open up the line so that you can get in there. We're going to deal with some other information in regards to our ancient story, because the overall objective here is knowledge of self, and also we are trying to get to the solution to the problems. Actually, solutions are being given, but we're going to get to some direct solutions here this evening, and we're going to try to cram it all into one broadcast. We can't come back with part two. Keep in mind, we are offering our free articles. Those of you who are on your social sites, send your friend request to Tahaka Amana El Bay. We'll put that in there so you can spread it, and that way they'll give you access. You can go over this information, write down the books and stuff that are mentioned in the broadcast for those of you who do not have them. And don't forget, the Africans who wrote the Bible by Nana Banche Dakwa, and get that book as well. We're going to be mentioning other books that you can get as you move along on your pace to instill the power of knowledge of self into the brain as a basic power base. And don't forget, we should all be involved in training, specialized training, and in preparations to take care of ourselves and learn how to hunt and fish and trap and fire high-powered rifles. You should be on any holiday that comes along. If it wasn't designed by your ancestors, well, you just leave that alone, go on into the gun range and practice. That way you'll be able to hit an animal from a great distance and make sure your weapons are modified, because you don't want to disturb the wilderness, and everything should be done in silent when you're doing this, and provide food for your family and stuff. Okay, so let's go on to
the next. You gotta have knowledge for life. You gotta have
It almost seems problematic and troubling that we still have to ask the question in the 21st century, is black history legitimate?
Right.
Do we still need to have these questions in these panels
right.
to address the issue of black history? Because in so doing, asking that question, we're basically asking somehow to be justified by the outside world. Somehow we have to prove that the black experience is legitimate. Okay. Is that better? Okay. So the question is, who are we trying to prove the legitimacy of black history to? Are we trying to prove it to the outside world, or are we trying to prove it to ourselves? Because seeking to justify black history, in a sense, is trying to seek to justify the very existence of black people. So if we have to ask the question about the history, we have to ask the question about who we are. So we're seeking to, is it okay for us to be? We can use our Ebonics. But we have the right to discuss black history. We have the right to explore black history simply because we exist. And all human beings have the right to explore their origins, their history, and their footprint on this earth. And we don't have to make any apologies for that. So we don't have to apologize to anybody else about Black History Month being a week, being in a month, or whether we interweave it within the history of the world. We don't make apologies for that. Why do y'all get a Black History Month? Well, because we study everybody else's history the other 11 months of the year. So that's the answer to that question. But if we can repeat some of the things that have already been said, black history is important because it goes to the foundations of human history. All human history is black history. Why? Because all humans begin in Africa. We know the story. First, we have the archaeological evidence which points to Central Africa, East Africa. We first had the first hominid species, Australopithecus afarensis. I'm sorry, I misspelled that one. That's the southern ape from the Afar region of Ethiopia that appeared 2.3 million years ago. Eventually, we evolved to Homo habilis, which is a handyman, tool-making man. Homo erectus, upright man, 1.5 million years ago. To finally, Homo sapiens sapiens, wise, thinking, intelligent human being, 200,000 years ago. So we've been intelligent since the very beginning. You have to constantly tell our children that because for some reason it's not cool to be intelligent. But we've been intelligent since the very beginning. Our second evidence of our origins, of course, go with the DNA evidence, that we can trace the mitochondrial DNA through the mother all the way to Eastern Africa and the Y chromosome through the father all the way to Southern Africa. So no matter where the evidence, be it archaeological, paleontological, genetic, all the evidence points to human history in Africa. So this is pretty well established. I think our young people are growing up with that, but most of us in this audience know that we didn't grow up with that knowledge. When Leakey was coming out with his knowledge, when Newsweek published the couple of Adam and Eve being black, it was all kind of furor.
Right.
The fact that people would actually believe that we all came from human beings.
Right.
So black history is everybody's history. But while black history is everyone's history, not everybody has the same story. And the story of black people everywhere throughout the diaspora is one of tremendous triumph and victory, and yet filled with almost unimaginable despair, pain, and suffering. Ours is a story of a rupture. It's a rupture of a culture, but of a memory as well. We have forgotten who we are, and how did this happen? It happened because we had a bomb dropped on us. It was a bomb that erased our memory. And I'm going to read the great Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, who writes in The Decolonizing of the Bomb, A Decolonizing of the Mind. The effect of a cultural bomb is to annihilate a people's belief in their names, in their languages, in their environment, in their heritage of struggle, in their unity, in their capacities, and ultimately in themselves. It makes them see their past as one wasteland of non-achievement and makes them want to distance themselves from that wasteland. It makes them want to identify with that which is the furthest removed from themselves. It makes them identify with that which is decadent and reactionary, all those forces which would stop their own springs of life. It even plants serious doubts about the moral righteousness of struggle. Possibilities of triumph and victory are seen as remote, ridiculous dreams. The intended results are despair, despondency, and a collective death wish. And how did all this happen? It began happening with slavery. Because slavery, a lot of people don't talk about this, not only did it impact African Americans, it impacted the continent as well. The population of Africa has remained constant for 300 years, the entire continent, whereas the population of Europe doubled, Asia tripled, and quadrupled. So the loss of the human resources to the African continent, a lot of people don't even examine that. It's not even a question in their mind. But it's important for us to understand how this all happened to us and the impact that it had on us as we deal with just African American history. Because history is not so much a study of the past, because everything has a past. A tree has a past. We can cut it down and see its rings. We know how old it is. We know if it was raining, if it was a drought. We can understand its past. Historian Orlando Patterson describes what slavery did to our minds. Not only was a slave denied all claims and obligations to his parents and living blood relations, but by extension, all such claims and obligations on his more remote ancestors and on his descendants. He was truly a genealogical isolate. Formally isolated in his social relations with those with whom he lived, he was also culturally isolated from his social heritage of his ancestors. He had a past, to be sure. Sticks and stones have a past. But a past is not a heritage. Everything, slaves differ from other human beings in that they were not allowed to freely integrate the experiences of their ancestors into their lives that would inform their understanding of their social reality with an inherited meaning of their natural forebears, or to anchor the living present in any conscious community of memory. So we lost our legacy. And I ask my students all the time, what is it that makes us human beings? They used to say, well, we can do tools. Well, we know that monkeys can have tools. Well, they say, well, we have memory. Well, elephants have memory. We know they have memory. Well, we show emotions. Well, we know that dolphins and other animals show emotions. We are human beings because we have a continual historical legacy. And it is our legacy that makes us human. It's our legacy that we've lost, our culture, and our memory. And if you don't have an identity and a legacy, you don't know who you are, and you're lost. Now, some people say this might be stretching it a bit, because obviously we're here, we exist. But what about our minds? Where are our minds? Do we even have our minds? If this is true on all levels, and sometimes you have to go to other sciences to help explain our condition. And one of the best sciences that we can look at, believe it or not, is physics. Because quantum physics, in addition to explaining so much of reality, really confirms what Africans have known all along. That's another lecture for another time. But according to physicist Fred Allen Wolfe, only when there is a confluence of past and future, a relationship that stretches across time, does knowledge present itself. Knowledge or mind is then a relationship to the future and to the past. That relationship appears as the present moment. Knowledge is thus the equivalent to meaning, and meaning is only present when there are two events, a future and a past. A mind without a past is no mind at all, and a mind without a future is no mind at all. If we look at some of our people today, young and old, it's very clear that we have many people in our communities who have totally lost their mind because we're existing in this weird space where we're not anchored to any kind of past and we can't prepare for any kind of future. But our ancestors knew this. And that's a beautiful thing. I study African history and African culture, too. And the thing that I always find about African culture is I think that they're always right. Through time, we're going to figure out that they had everything all figured out. And if we're smart, we'll follow them.
So the real thing about history is the understanding of a value system. The fundamental question is, what do you stand for? What are your values? All of us sitting in this room did not just suddenly drop. We are all part of a value system. We are all part of a group. We are all part of a community. History is a story about people. It's about understanding how a community has shaped itself over time. It's about understanding how people have lived their lives over time. And history must have meaning. So we want to study and pretty much what Ms. McCoy and Reverend McCoy said, Ms. Peters and Reverend McCoy have stated, that when you get into studying history, it is one thing to memorize the facts and dates. But one of the fundamental questions we ask is, how does history inform our present? How does history inform our lives? When I got into the study of history, especially as I studied history a little more detailedly, that was one of the key questions. Everything about history should have a meaning, should have some way of influence the way we live. Earlier, we talked about some of the problems which the African-American community face. And these problems did not suddenly begin today. These problems are deeply rooted in history. All of you probably heard the name W.E.B. Du Bois. In one of the pamphlets, a book which he published in 1903, The Souls of Black Folk, he asked a fundamental question in that book. Will America be America without its black people? A very significant question, right? When you look at the black experience in America, and it's been ably stated, that when we talk about African-American history, we must contextualize it within American history. Because African-American history, if we study African-American history as just something on the side, then we are actually promoting the study of some type of segregated history. And the question about it is that if you look at some of the central themes in the understanding of American history, virtually every theme, as Peter talked about, before the Civil War, you cannot study American history for the Civil War, or the Civil War, without understanding the story of black people. The story of black people is deeply integrated in this history. Again, one of the things, as I said earlier, that history is particularly important for us because it teaches us our traditions. It teaches us our values. It has already been stated that many of those who do not have a sense of history spend their life drifting. And so out of our history, out of our past, we have what we have today. And one of the fundamental challenges that we must engage ourselves in, when we study history, we learn, we appreciate what has been done in the past, we enjoy some of the things which have been left for us by those who went before, but we must challenge ourselves. It is not enough to inherit. One of the fundamental questions is, what are we doing to act to the next, to what the next generation will get? So it's not enough. So one of the real challenges which, and I say this a lot to people when I talk, my students at the University of Dayton, sometimes they accuse me of overkill, that sometimes I say too much about some of these things. That it's not enough to study history. It's not enough to see the good things. I mean, we all know the story of the Civil Rights Movement. We are all standing on the shoulders of the Civil Rights Movement. Without the Civil Rights Movement, I come originally from Cameroon in West Africa. Right? I've been living in the United States for 26 years. We have a program in Africa. Most of my research is in Africa, in different countries. But without the Civil Rights Movement, clearly I would not be standing here giving this talk. Right? So clearly the Civil Rights Marches, and it was ably stated. Sometimes people say that history is a study of lucky people, in the sense that those true movers and shakers, those who really make things happen, their names never appear in the books. Right? Martin Luther King would never have been a leader without the foot soldiers, without the grassroots people. Malcolm X would never have been a leader without the foot soldiers, without the grassroots people. So these grassroots people, the rank and file, the masses, the people whom would have mobilized, the people whose stories, whose names will never appear in the books, they're all responsible, I think, for all of us being able to get into the bus and walk through the bus and sit down instead of paying the toll up front, walk out and enter through the rear. These are simple things which are so critical because they go right to the heart of what it means to be human, right? So history is a story about trying to find out how each generation defined what it means to be human. History is a story about trying to construct our identity. One of the fundamental questions we must ask ourselves, what does it mean to be African American in America in 2008? History deals with change over time. And one of the things I mentioned that I teach African American history, I teach African history. And we ask this question all through. In 1900, what does it mean to be African American? In 1920, what does it mean to be African American? In 1930, this is so important because we understand the story of hope. We understand the story of endurance. We understand the story of protest. We understand the story of proud people who are doing the best to build a community despite all the odds. I mean, so it is the story of the African American people. It is a story of the oppressed. So history is so critical in us trying to understand this this story about the people. Again, one of the things I said earlier is that when we study history, we try to understand who we are. History helps us to construct our identity. How does the African American construct his or her identity? What does it mean, again, to be African American? How is that identity constructed, right? I mean, so you find, for example, the whole story of race. I mean, the other day in one of my classes, we were talking about the construction of the racial identity in America, that it is based on scientific fraud. And so one of the things you find here is that racial identity in America is socially constructed. And that's why you could find a lot of cases of passing, right? It's not based on any science. It's based on where you live, which school you went to, which never. So clearly, and of course, this racial identity changed over time. As you look at the census data in the 1900s, you look at the census data in the 1930s, you look at the census data in the 1960s, there are changes. And so history helped us to begin to make sense, help us to try to understand and hold a nation accountable. Help us to, when we study Martin Luther King, when we study Malcolm X, when we study Frederick Douglass, when we study Ida B. Wells, when we study Mary McLeod Bethune, it's not so much that we're interested in the story. We're trying to see in what ways we can emulate their lives. These are people who made a significant contribution. How can we be like them? How can we challenge ourselves to do the things they did? These are people who acted out of history. They didn't just go along. They didn't just say, let's get along, everything is fine. They didn't just accommodate, right? These are people who said, every so often, every generation must stand up to the truth. Every generation must stand up to what it means to be human. Why should we study history? Because it informs the lives we live. It challenges us to be better people. It challenges us, where the Reverend talked earlier about the need to be good to our neighbors. King said at one point, his quotation may be wrong, that at a certain point, everyone is potentially another one's neighbor. Right? And so be good to your neighbor. So history challenges us to do those type of things.
American heritage, but always when we talk about our history, we have to start with Africa, because Africa is the home of humanity, and our children need to know that. They need to appreciate what Africa is. When I was teaching at Colonel White, every day when the young people came in, there was something on the board for them to copy, which kept them busy and quiet while I took attendance. One day I simply put up the fact that Africa is the home of humanity when Dr. Leakey was doing all of his research. And I had a few details about how they had found this out. And when I finished and gave the children a chance to speak, one of them said, "Miss Peters, you mean everybody came from Africa?" And I said, "Yes, everybody." And he said, "Damn, that's good," and broke into a broad smile. He was happy because he has seen so much junk about Africa.
Right.
You know, that Africa is a jungle, but
right.
Dr. Ivan Van Sertima tells us that percentage-wise, there is more jungle in Europe than there is in Africa.
Right.
They need to know that they are the descendants of the people who built the pyramids, that Egypt is in Africa, even though you have assorted people who would like to pretend that it is not. It was Africans who built the Great Pyramid, which is the only one of the seven wonders of the ancient world that is still standing. And you have engineers today who still cannot figure out how those Africans were able to move those stones, many of them weighing more than a ton, to build the Great Pyramid. So I don't let my children tell me I can't do math. All right. Our people built the pyramids. Today I was out at Trotwood Madison speaking with the students in a science class. Asked them how many want to be doctors. Raise their hand. I said, how many know the Hippocratic Oath? And a couple knew that that was a Greek doctor. And I said, did you know that almost everything that's in the Greek text was copied from the ancient Egyptian text because they were doing surgery when there was no such place as Greece or Europe? So our children need to know that. That that's who we are descended from. And from Africa, of course, we come to America. We don't start in 1492 when Columbus got here and didn't know where he was. We mention the fact that when Columbus got here, there were already black people here. They had sailed here from West Africa. So we were here. All you have to do is look at those giant heads down in Mexico with the African features, because we don't want our children to equate the word African with slave. It's essential that they know that every country at one point was enslaved. The whole Roman Empire, the Greek Empire, those were built on slavery. So we need to get rid of that image. We also teach them, of course, the Civil War, which is another whole story. But one of the things we wanted to do in the book on black history of Dayton is that so often people think of history as something that happened somewhere else and didn't have anything to do with my city or my family. And by doing this book, we were able to show them that, yes, Dayton, your family, is an important part of history. The original book, the one that had Mack Ross on the cover, was written in 1995 when Dayton had its bicentennial. And Mack Ross, of course, was a graduate of Roosevelt High School, was one of the first five Tuskegee Airmen, was in the same class as General Benjamin O. Davis, Jr. So when our children watch that movie of the Tuskegee Airmen, they need to know that there were Daytonians who were Tuskegee Airmen, and we still have some living with us. We are very blessed because we're losing our World War II veterans. But C.I. Williams is still with us. Mr. Charles Feaster is still with us. And we have recorded their stories for the Library of Congress Veterans History Project. It's essential that we do that. In the book, we also talked about the fact that people in Dayton were on the Underground Railroad, that you had First Wesleyan Methodist Church was a station on the Underground Railroad. There were white people in Dayton who were on the Underground Railroad, but they don't know that. So when we study Harriet Tubman, we also study Daytonians who were a part of the Underground Railroad. We talk also about those men who were in the Civil War. Charles Austin, great local historian, gave us a list of all of the black men from this county who served in the Civil War. And we have in the book a portrait of a couple of them. One of them, Mr. Moody, we have his photograph when he was 100 years old, celebrating with a steak dinner. He was in the Battle of Gettysburg. So when our children read about the Battle of Gettysburg and hear that magnificent Gettysburg Address, they need to know that Daytonians, black Daytonians, were in the Civil War. We talk also about a period that Rayford Logan called the low point of the Negro's existence in the United States, which was the period after the betrayal by Rutherford B. Hayes, when the troops were taken out of the South, when Charles Sumner's civil rights bill was declared invalid by the Supreme Court, and you have so many black people who left the South in the Great Migration. This couple here, this was Joseph and Lucille Shaw, who came to Dayton from South Carolina. who began Shaw Cleaners. Shaw Cleaners is still with us today. It is run by their great-grandson. And so when we look at that, we need to know that is a fourth-generation black business, which we need to support. We talk also about people such as James Dunn, who was the first black to graduate from The Ohio State University with a degree in engineering, served in the county engineering department, built a lot of the roads that we are still using. We talk also about C.J. McLean Sr. C.J. McLean Sr. was the one, of course, who taught many black people how to vote because they had not been allowed to do that in the South. And he built up political power in Dayton. He also was concerned about the fact that many young black people could not get jobs on the West Side because the stores were owned by whites. So he started what was called the West Side Movement to make them hire young black people. Because of that, his home was bombed in a vain attempt to get him to stop what he was doing. But we want people to know that he did that. When I was doing the book, I found a black newspaper, the Dayton Forum, that had a list of the young people who had worked with C.J. McLean Sr. And as I went down the list, I found Thomas Peters at 981 Washington. That was my uncle, and he never told me that he had been involved in that. So one of the things that we have to do is share with our young people what we have gone through. Lots of times I hear people upset because kids don't know anything about Martin Luther King Jr. How can they if we don't teach them? It is up to us to teach our history. We cannot count on the schools to do it. One of the things that Malcolm X said was that you do not hear Jewish people running around demanding that the schools teach Jewish history. They teach their own history to their own children. And that is what we have to do. Okay? That is our responsibility.
You gotta have knowledge for life. You gotta have knowledge for life. You gotta have knowledge for life.
On my travel to Africa, I travel by Ethiopian Airlines, and Ethiopian Airlines is one of the best airlines in the world and one of the best in Africa. And Ethiopian Airlines is an airline that actually has its origin in the Black Eagles. The Black Eagles was African Americans after Ethiopia was invaded by the Italians. And the Emperor Haile Selassie had to flee from Ethiopia into Europe, and particularly Britain. He then called upon the world to help him return to Ethiopia to remove the Italians. African Americans, actually, because of, again, their knowledge of Ethiopia and the importance, actually rallied to, in fact, he formed what is called the Ethiopian World Federation. In fact, there was a branch in Harlem, New York. And so brothers who had learned to fly actually went and helped him establish an air force. And out of that air force came the Ethiopian airline, one of the best in the world. In fact, Ethiopians actually have some of the best mechanics in the world right now flying those airplanes. Ethiopian Airlines took me to Accra, Ghana, and from Accra, Ghana, I had to get another airline because Liberia has experienced more than 14 years of civil war, so you can't just fly directly into Monrovia. The airport was destroyed and all that. So, but this is a regional airline called Bellevue, and it's owned by a Nigerian. So Nigerians do have money, you know, they own airlines. This airline flies throughout West Africa and flies all the way to India as well. Bellevue flew me from Accra, Ghana to Monrovia. And again, one of the fascinating things about flying African airlines, it reminds you of your culture because you have stewardess and pilots who are Africans flying these planes. And in fact, in the case of Bellevue, I actually ate Liberian food on the plane. I mean, you don't be eating, like, you know, African food on planes. So I ate Liberian food on Bellevue, so I want to make sure that I remember that. This is the Black Star Square in Ghana. And I told you we're celebrating the 50th year anniversary. Black Star Square is one of the central places in Ghana. And in tribute to Nkrumah, you know, Nkrumah actually chose the Black Star from Marcus Garvey. I don't know if you know that history and all that. This is Kwame Nkrumah National Park. And if you know the history of Kwame Nkrumah, he was educated here at Lincoln University. He was exposed to Marcus Garvey's ideas about a United States of Africa. He had heard that idea before from Ghana because, in fact, a Liberian, Edward Wilmer Blyden, had proposed the idea. But I think when he came and saw African Americans really working on this idea of the United States of Africa, he was inspired and literally then took that banner back to Africa, and that's what we have, an African Union. It is out of the view of Kwame Nkrumah that we have this African Union. And so there's a national park to Kwame Nkrumah. This is his mausoleum in the national park. His wife was from Egypt. In fact, when I got there, she had just been buried in the mausoleum about 2 months. She had just died last year, and they took her back to Ghana and buried her in the mausoleum, Kwame Nkrumah. This is National Theater in Ghana. This is where I hear, this is where Jay-Z performed when he was there, you know, so. In the form of a boat, because the Ghanaians, especially in Accra, actually are very sea, they're heavily influenced by the sea. The slave castle, Ghana has about 38 of these slave castles. This is where our, you know, African-American ancestors, actually, you know, Ghana, one of the places. This is the oldest of the slave castles. This is Elmina. In fact, this slave castle is 500 years old. There's a structure that's been there for 500 years. It started off not as a slave castle, just as a place of trading gold and grain and all that. And then when slavery came in, they became the dungeons. Perhaps some of our ancestors went through those doors. The door of no return. There's a fishing village right outside of door of no return. Okay, I told you Ghana, again, right outside of door of no return, you find this fishing village in Ghana. This is it.
Okay, Morris, we're back. If any of you have any comments, go ahead and raise your hand. We're going into the underbelly of the broadcast now. And we have yet to hear from Dr. Amos Wilson again, as well as Dr. Umar Johnson. So you all sit tight, and we have some very, very powerful information to deliver to you for these two brothers. So if you have paper and pencil, that's a good thing, and you want to write down the books that are mentioned in the broadcast. We have another book that I want to mention. I think I've already mentioned it, The Moors in Spain by Stella Lane Poole. That is a must for your library. You definitely want to have that book in your library, and so that you can read along and get a very, very detailed portrait of what life was like in the past for our people. Very, very important. Now, as far as your health is concerned, I'd like to recommend African Holistic Health by Dr. Layla O'Africa, How to Eat to Live by Elijah Muhammad. I think I've mentioned Of Water in the Spirit by Maladoma Patrice Somme, and also Africana, the concise, best reference by Malala Karenga. I want you to get that. And, of course, inside our archives, we do have the many more books that I probably won't be able to mention here this evening, but that they are available there for you to get as well. And we want to get another book called My Bondage and My Freedom by Douglas Dover, and Black Man of the Now by Ben Jokinen, Yosef Ben Jokinen. That's a very, very powerful book. And you want to get that and add that to your library. And these are very, very good books. Wonders of the African World by Henry Louis Gates. Now, that is a very fine illustrated book, and I highly recommend that you get that book there and add that to your library as well. Okay? And these are just a few of the books that I want to recommend that you read, and make sure you have in your home that's easily available for your children so that they can get that. And so at any time they are faced with any type of falsehood, they're able to regurgitate the truth and with verification and documentation to back up as evidence their claim. Okay?
I was doing a lecture here on self-hatred. And in the very first lecture, I dealt with the image of the blonde, blue-eyed Jesus. And I made the statement that you had to beware of a church such that when you walk into it, the first thing you see is a blonde, blue-eyed Jesus back behind the altar. That church is lying to you. And that church is going to have send you to hell. How did I say that? Because first of all, there's nowhere in the Bible that a description of that Jesus has ever been given. And secondly, that Bible strictly states that graven images should not be made. And it's done. And one minister jumped up, offended because of that statement, and took the statement personally. And I'm a minister in the such and such a church, and I took a course under Dr. Cohn at Columbia University, and you know, just laid it all out for you, and objected to it as if I were attacking the minister directly, when I was dealing with the concept, and I was dealing with the psychology of having gods painted in alien forms, and how that induces self-hatred and maintains self-hatred in the people. How praying to a white man is damaging to black people. And how thinking of God as a white man is damaging to black people. I'm dealing with the concept here. Yet she felt a need to defend what she thought of as herself and her profession. But in defending herself, she actually defended the system. She actually defended the status quo. And many of us then, as neurotics, you see, as we engage in our neurotic and maladjusted behavior and defend our egos and defend our vanities and defend our pride, actually support and hold up the system. Parent or justify the abusing family. And how we, in many instances, end up justifying the system that abuses us. Integration itself indicates that, wanting to live and be loved and lay around with people who destroyed us and enslaved us and given us the greatest pain in the world. Sometimes what we call in psychology the love of the aggressor. The people you want to love most are the people who've done the most damage to you. Unhealthy personalities cannot be created by healthy environments. Since the unhealthy of an individual or group can result in the relative health, wealth, security and our power and sense of identity of another individual or group, then it serves the interests of the latter group. In other words, the unhealth of the black community serves the health and wealth of the white community. Just as the sickness of the drug addict serves the health and wealth of the pusher. So in a sense then, it becomes in the interest of the pusher to keep the addict, of course, addicted, even though he claims he's doing him a service and a favor. The latter group becomes dependent, that is the unhealthy group, comes to need the unhealthiness, and that is the dominant group, really becomes dependent and comes to need the unhealthiness of the former. If the health of the former means a reduction in the dominance of the latter, then the latter resists the health of the former despite its pretensions to the contrary. In other words, when we even see assimilationism, we don't have time to talk about it here tonight, but in many ways, assimilationism and integrationism is really another prompt for the maintenance of white power. And while we thought that we bought it in to a great extent, I would argue that to a good extent, the white ruling class helped to push it as well, because it also helps to maintain the white ruling class in power. When you have a minority of people, such as the European, often in order to stay in power, they must recruit from the very people they oppress. And therefore, they will call up from those people, certain talented people or other types, who then will identify with their masters and help them to maintain the control over the masses. This often will be called integration and will often be called desegregation. But ultimately, if you look very closely, you'll notice one thing, that the real power relationship between those two groups has not changed. I talk about a number of things we call constants, that if we look closely in the relationship at the relationship between Europeans and Africans, we will note that there are certain basic things that have not changed despite all of the other things we look at, despite integrationism, despite political and social change. There are things that are still basically the same and have been the same for the last 400 years. The real power of black people, particularly if you talk about military power, has not changed fundamentally since the very time we met the European. You may find African countries now with jet planes and tanks that they bought from Europeans, by the way, and still have yet to make. And you may think then that the Africans have entered into a modern era in warfare and so forth, but I would dare say that there's not a single African country that could really protect the interests of black people against European power, particularly as that power moves out into space and can rain down on the African continent bombs and laser weapons and other weapons of various types. And African countries having no anti-ballistic system, no Star Wars system, no system to fight war in space is literally defenseless. And yet they may fly the latest American jets, and in the face of American and European war power, we are still ultimately defenseless. That has not changed fundamentally in 400 years, ladies and gentlemen. The European economic control of this globe fundamentally has not changed either. The European control of information has not changed fundamentally either. The European control of definition, the definition of reality, the definition of what is and is not, has not changed fundamentally either. That has been the case for a long time. The European tendency to degrade things African has not changed as well. You may now have a degree in computer technology. You may now have a job that pays you $40,000 to $50,000 to $60,000 a year. But your fundamental relationship to the European has not changed one whit from the fundamental relationship between our African forefathers and his European slave master. For as you work your computers, you still work to the profits of Europeans. And so the fact that we've moved into the executive offices does not mean we've moved into power. Does not mean that the fundamental power relationship between Europeans and Africans have changed one bit. As a matter of fact, the moving of blacks into the executive offices is an effort to maintain that power. and to obscure that power behind a form of neocolonialism. I don't think it is an accident that the desegregation movement and the assimilationist movement in America parallel the neocolonial movement in Africa. As I often tell my classes, you as black students are now being educated to put a black face on white power and to help deceive your people into thinking because you've got a job, we have moved forward as a people. Let's then just take a quick look at the functions of maladjustment and why you cannot get blacks, why it is important that blacks never get out of their sickness. You ever wondered why the more social workers you produce, the crazier people get? The more psychologists you produce, the crazier people get. You ever wondered about that? I lost a job challenging whites about that. Why you, as a white man, whom these crazy people have permitted to be chairman of the Department of Predominantly Hispanic and Black College, why do you as a black man, a white man, continue to try to bring these psychologists in here when you know that this psychology is not doing the black and Hispanic community one whit of good? He could not disagree with that. How do you pretend to judge the qualifications of black people for teaching other black people and Hispanic teachers and Hispanic students when you admit every day in the New York educational system that you don't know how to educate black children? We have a group of people who lament about their inability to educate black children, how black children are so-called uncontrollable and ineducable and all of that, and yet they want to sit on a board and determine who is qualified and not qualified. We have this insult downtown where these white dogs are going to try to determine who should be the chancellor of New York City schools, and yet have admitted that they cannot educate black children. And we'll sit there and let them try to lay the foundation to tell us what the credentials of an educator is supposed to be. How do you qualify to tell us what the credentials of an educator is supposed to do? You have not demonstrated that you are capable of educating black people, but yet there are a lot of us who want to sit back and talk about standards and degrees and all this other nonsense that the people who clearly admitted that they failed have laid upon us. And yet we have a lot of this going on in the system. But this kind of stuff must happen if black people are to continue to be subordinated. How is it functional? The captive African maladjustment justifies European dominance and exploitation. Because we are crazy, because we are criminals, because we are addicts, because we are that, the Europeans have a right to put their police in our community. They have a right to run the welfare agencies that keep us crazy, by the way. They have a right to intrude into our cultural families and personal lives. Why? Because, you see, they are maladjusted. They have learning deficiencies. They have this and that. Therefore, we're coming in to help and treat them in some sort of way. We are bringing in foreign aid. We are calling on the IMF to study and regulate their national economies and so forth. So you will see the so-called sickness and dependency and lagging in development and all of these other kinds of things every day are justifications for the Europeans to intrude upon African life and seek to control that life. And when we accept their definitions, we accept their dominance. We ask for their dominance, and we see their dominance as some kind of aid to us. Yet when we look some 40 years later, we are in the same position or in a worse position than before. How do we solve it? Asking.
Six sciences that all schools for black children need to have. Agricultural and agronomical sciences, but culture without agriculture. You got to teach them how to grow their own food, how to live off the land. You cannot go to war with white people and not have a food supply. Okay? What would Los Angeles do? What would black LA do if the whites and Mexicans and Koreans and Arabs shut down all your food stores? How would you eat? Okay. If you couldn't get no more fried chicken or fried rice than a 20-cent soda, just sell that bag of chips. What would you do? The next one is financial and economic science. Money science. Money science. We are a money illiterate people. Our children need to be taught real estate. They need to be taught the stock market. They need to be taught resource investment. Are y'all following me? We got to throw out the old mode of education. Public education for blacks is an education to fit in and work for white people. They don't have any jobs for us anymore. So the new education is an education for what? Power acquisition. That's it. Not to work for white people, but to challenge them and take over their businesses. That's the new African of the future. Okay? So you have agricultural, agronomical, economic, financial. You need dietary and nutritional. Our children got to be taught how to maintain their bodies. Because we ain't doing a good job. And I ain't going to lie. Aunt Annie's pretzels in the airport is killing me. I'm about to go on a fast. I try not to eat them, but the plane be taking too long to board. But that's my New Year's resolution. No more Aunt Annie's in the airport. That's going to be hard. You say, how you doing? Okay? And what's the fourth one, y'all? Spiritual and astrological science. Children come here to the Karasin and they get taught the science of the ancestors, the science of God. They got to be taught that. Because most of us was raised on what? Islam or Christianity. And I'm not knocking either one, okay? It's how you use a religion, okay? But in Islam and Christianity, you're basically taught that anything other than what that teaches is automatically the God's work.
Right.
So ignorance becomes godly, not knowing about everything else.
Right.
You see, so we have to teach our children ancient African spiritual systems, all of them, very important. Because you got to connect to your ancestors.
Yes.
And if you ain't dealing with your ancestors, you ain't dealing with you. You ain't dealing with God because you come from God through the ancestral umbilical cord. And you can't get back to God unless you go back through the umbilical cord. So if you think you're going to deal with great-great-great-grandmama, you ain't even dealt with grandma. It ain't going to work out. So venerating our ancestors is a significant part of our political struggle because if you don't include them in it, the infinite, invisible, in the war, you can't win it. White people are always calling on their ancestors. The name of every building they got is invoking an ancestor. We going to the J. Edgar Hoover Hall. We going to the Samuel Coleridge disc. We going to that. We going to that. Actually, Samuel Coleridge was a brother. But we going to this. We going to that. You got to be careful. Very careful. Thank you. Okay. Got to make sure that bottle snaps. No, I'm being real, not my brother. You don't know. See, I ain't gonna brought the water in. We don't know. But that's how they get rid of us. Okay? And when I have my reading, they tell me I gotta watch what I eat and what I drink and where else. Not the Karasin, y'all. We just don't know who's bringing the water in. That's all.
Dr. Umar, what about computer literacy?
Computer literacy, I think, should be taught. But the only thing we got to be careful with the computer literacy is that we don't let our children get dependent on the computer. Because what's happening now is our children are dependent on the internet to get all their homework done. So they're no longer doing true research. If they got to do a book report on Ida B. Wells, you know what they're going to do? They're going to type her name into the search engine. They're going to copy the whole thing, put it on the paper. You're going to go to the library and get books that have been published, and you're going to do real research. We are allowing this computer age to handicap our children intellectually, and we got to stop doing it. Okay? I can put anything on the internet about Ida B. Wells, it don't mean it's true.
Right.
Okay? Your child's whole life should not be inside the house.
Right.
And that's what's going on. As a result of that, obesity is going up, especially for our girls. Okay? But some of our girls are obese. Why? Because they're eating themselves to deal with the sexual trauma that you don't get addressed. Significant portion of the girls that I work with who are obese, our little sisters are obese because they're eating themselves to deal with sexual pains. I was molested by my uncle. My mommy won't do nothing about it. My daddy won't even do anything about it. And so I'm just going to go to the refrigerator and cope with my pain. A lot of us do that. When you find yourself drifting to the refrigerator when you ain't feeling well, you're a food addict. You use food as a drug. And food is a drug. Okay? You find yourself grabbing some soda. You need some soda, some Kool-Aid, in order to feel a little bit better. You got to watch that. That's where that obesity. Most black folk ain't obese because they love food. They love the pleasure food gives them.
Right.
To help them escape from their pain.
Right.
You gotta remember that.
Yeah.
Okay, and I also believe that at least 25% of the pain and hurt that black women feel towards black men. I think one of the reasons why our relationship is so distant is because a lot of our women have been sexually abused by black men.
Right.
So all black men become a symbol of that first hurt. And it makes it hard for a sister to trust a black man when she was taken advantage of by a black man. You see? So we got to get something about this. And grandparents, you got kids who you know are child molesters, they got to get out the house. If you don't want to send them to jail, send them to the hospital. You got to get some help, but you can't let them stay around here and molest the whole family. This ain't working. Okay? You got pedophile on top of pedophile. I'm getting phone calls, cousins, and the homosexual pedophilia with a 13-year-old cousin molesting a 6-year-old little cousin. Okay, one boy, his cousin put his privates in his mouth. This is the type of stuff that I'm dealing with, okay? Some of the boys are making sex videos, doing all types of trifling stuff to the little girls. Mother called me, "Brother Umar, look at this video my son made with his friends. Look what they did to this little 12-year-old girl." It's bad, because we're exposing our children to sex too early, okay? That's supposed to be forbidden until they get older. But when you're 6 years older, you're allowed to watch TV and people having sex. And you with your 2-year-old little cousin, let me see if it works the same way. Who put the idea in their head? You. Okay? With the little girls, you got to watch. That's why I don't think the little girl should be sitting on men's lap.
Santa Claus.
They love you.
Okay? Because the male reproductive organ is a very sensitive organ. You understand? So any touch, breathe, anything. Okay? He got your niece on the lap and he busy shaking. What the hell you doing with my niece? Teaching her how to play the drum. Where the drum at? So she sits over here. And then you got to train your daughters not to be so fast around men. They running, jumping. Oh, I never saw you before. And your boys too. Because it works male and female. I know a man who confessed to me that his mother used to climb in the bed with him every night. Molested by his mother, yes. Emotional problems. This is, I'm telling you, I can do a book on them cases. That's why I know what the Roman Catholic Church is doing. I'm talking about the church on the corner. Okay? It's the rule of religion. Then the mother and the father don't want to say them because the pastor has a high-ranking position in the community. So we can't tell on him because we'll be ostracized. So our kids just got to be quiet about that. And the next thing you know, they shooting up the whole neighborhood.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, what happened to him? Anybody know? Oh, you know, but ain't nobody going to tell. Okay? Mass incarceration. We got to do something about mass incarceration. Prisons are nothing but slave ships without water. Okay? We have to teach our young men to stop committing crime in the first place. But we understand that most crime is politically motivated. What did they do at the end of slavery? At the end of slavery, you didn't have any statewide prison systems. After slavery, you did. Because they knew that they wasn't going to give black men jobs, so they simply did what? Upgraded vagrancy crimes to major felonies. So they filled the jails with black men who had to steal to feed their families. And then the first black president came along, Bill Clinton. They gave us what? 3 strikes and you out. Mandatory minimum sentencing. For the first time in American history, you could go to jail for the rest of your life, and you didn't put your hands on nobody. And y'all voted for him like crazy, twice. So after Bill Clinton, they knew Obama, you would go crazy over him.
Mm-hmm.
He got good hair, too. You didn't know what to do with yourself. And you're like, I'm going to the inauguration. I'm going to spend my whole savings on an inauguration. Obama won't even look at you and smile, but I'm going to do an inauguration. They're like when Passion of the Christ came out. Remember that? Mel Gibson, racist. He made a movie about white Jesus, Passion of the Christ. Churches were filling up big buses with thousands of blacks.
Yeah, they go
supporting a movie about white racist man. Eugenics. This comes out of psychology. Eugenics is what? Good stock. The word means good stock. Coined by Francis Galton, who was cousin to Charles Darwin, who justified the colonization of Africa. Eugenics is the science of African racial extermination. It means the selective breeding of white people and the systematic extermination of black people. One of the first major programs for eugenics was what? Planned Parenthood, which was originally called the Negro Project. How many black babies have been aborted in America since 1970? 3 million. So when we talk about the Hispanics taking over, they only take it over. Well, most of them are African anyway, but for the sake of conversation, they only take it over because we kill our babies. They don't kill his.
Right.
Black women per capita get more abortions than everyone else, and it ain't got to do with poverty because you got poor whites, poor Hispanics, poor Asians. They do not kill their children. You kill your children because you don't want to see something else that looks like you. Stop being in denial. Same reason why a lot of black men date white women.
How about that?
Because they don't want their kids to look like them.
Yeah.
Problem is, you don't know how nature going to operate.
Right, right.
You can have sex with a blue-eyed, blonde-haired Anglo-Saxon, and that baby come out looking like Shaka Zulu. Spear and everything. Hey, Dad. Hey, Dad. You don't control that. I know biracial children who look almost white. I know some who look like they ain't got a white parent at all.
Wow.
You don't control that, so you sleeping with a white woman hoping your baby going to come out with green eyes. They come out looking just like you.
How about that?
So, and plus, we got to stop mixing the seed up.
Right.
Okay, you got to stop mixing that seed up, okay? Then for my biracial brothers and sisters, I don't see any difference between us and them. If they loyal to the race, then they African like the rest of us. I don't practice that type of thing.
Malcolm.
Okay, it's all about commitment to the culture and loyalty to the race. So if you got an African parent and you identify as African, then guess what? You African. Okay, that's how I go. But I'm saying psychologically, historically, we have to understand that race in between,
right.
That race in between has always been used historically to oppress us. When the Greeks and Romans came into Africa, they didn't beat the African armies with white men. They used the mulatto children. Those were the armies. Okay, so we have to recognize how that biracial child has been used in history against their darker brothers.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is we have a big light-skinned supremacy problem in the black community.
Yes,
we do.
And y'all know it because a lot of y'all practice it. Okay? And I'm not talking about the light-skinned people. Okay? You can be blue, black, purple, and be a light-skinned supremacist. Light-skinned supremacy refers to what? A belief, a psychological construct that you have created that says the lighter you are, the better you are.
Yes.
You could be blue, black, purple, be a light-skinned supremacist.
Yes.
In fact, most light-skinned supremacists I've met have been dark, not light.
Yeah.
Okay? Clarence Thomas, Supreme Court Justice. Blue, black, purple, and he's a light-skinned supremacist. He's married to George Bush's cousin? He's married to George Bush's first cousin.
Yeah.
That's his wife. And he's a pastor and had the nerve to marry Rush Limbaugh, the most racist radio host in America, in his house.
Oh.
See, what good is all those degrees if you don't even love you? And that's why we got to teach black children loyalty to race before we teach them anything else. Because if you teach them science before you teach them self-love, the science will be used against you.
Right.
You want to teach them medicine before you teach them self-love, the medicine going to be used against you.
Right.
Teach that first. Knowledge of self precedes all other knowledges.
Yes.
That's right.
Okay? Very important that we understand that. So we talked about agricultural and agronomical, financial and economic. Science of the black man, science of the black woman. Black boys have to be taught about the woman, and women got to be taught about the men. Dietary, nutritional science so they stay alive, and also political and military science.
That's right.
Our sons need to be taught how to use guns. The girls do.
Yeah.
That's right. How to clean your urine if you're out in the woods and it ain't no drinkable water. There's the science to clean your urine so you can make it drinkable. That's written. They need to be told that. How to start a fire without no matches. They need to be told that because this ain't promised to you. Okay? And according to white supremacy, do you know what's supposed to happen to the United States? In order for the one world order to produce itself, the United States is supposed to split into three independent countries. A civil war has to be born so the international police could come in, save the day, and now you have one world government. So there will be chaos in America. And a lot of these little experiments you see, Columbine in Connecticut and Dark Knight in Virginia Tech, these are just trial runs for the one to come. That's right. So get ready for this. The problem with black people is we trust white people so much, we think that they're always going to be in charge. White supremacy must fall. The problem is the Chinese supremacy won't be any better than the white supremacy.
Uh-huh.
In fact, it's going to be worse because the white man make you think he like you because he ain't got the numbers. So he got to work with you. Chinese people got the numbers. You see what they do in the Chinese store. You come in there, you short 5 cents. Go get five.
Okay.
Hold on, dog. I've been buying from you. Go get five. You want chicken or not? 5 cents.
No, don't talk to me. Five. I said, I grew up on your dog. Five. Well, get out of here. And what do? Go get five. They ain't got time for no white supremacy tricks and games and stuff like that. You go to the Korean hair care distributor, I need to get a box of perm. I need 45 bottles of perm. Okay, well, they cost $8 a piece times 45. Are you like, can I get a deal? Can I get a hookup?
Nope.
Do you want to not? They don't play them games with us. So imagine them being in control of things. I don't want to hear none of that. You go to him, talk about them. Look, we study African religion. You study Buddha. Buddha born in Asia. Me Chinese. 8 times 5. They're not letting you come in with them or know nothing. You see how they are? They have nothing but contempt for black people. Nothing but contempt. Shooting kids in the back. Kids in buying food. All her life, she spilled one soda, and she gets shot in the back dead. And we right back there the next day, buying the face. Okay? Trayvon Martin died, we all go buy hoodies. We made Champion rich, Nike rich, Adidas rich.
Arizona Ice too.
This is what we do. And everybody bought a pack of Skittles. Didn't even know Skittles was giving money to Zimmerman's defense. White people work together. That's what Connecticut was about, y'all. That's what Connecticut was about. Arm all the white people, arm all the teachers, arm all the school police, so they will be in a position to kill black people, and then invoke the Stand Your Ground law. You don't see how all this is connected? They preparing for Zimmerman to get an easy sentence, which is going to give white people the incentive to start shooting blacks and then stand back and say, I did it because I thought my life was in danger.
Right. Yeah.
That's what makes the Stand Your Ground law a throwback to Jim Crow.
Right.
Because you don't have to prove that they was going to hurt you.
Right.
You just got to prove that you felt
right.
that
right.
your life was in danger. What kind of law is that?
Crazy.
And half the states in America now have either adopted or are considering adoption of Stand Your Ground. White people shooting black people in cold blood and saying, I fought, my life was in danger. Y'all heard about the brother, another one in Florida at the gas station with his woman. White man came out there and told him to turn his music down. He told the white man where to go. White man opened fire, blew his head off. And guess what the white man saying? Stay on your ground. They said, how? He said, because I thought he was reaching in his glove compartment for a gun. All this is connected.
Right.
Connecticut is connected to the Zimmerman case. The reason why you didn't get a verdict on Zimmerman because they wanted to make sure y'all voted for Obama, so Obama delayed the case.
Yeah.
I got to wake up to this thing. And you got to understand something about eugenics. Some of y'all running around talking about black people born gay, right? That comes out of eugenics theory.
Yeah.
Eugenics theory says that personality traits are inherited. If you don't take care of your kids, it was in your genes. You don't like the work, it was in your genes. You want to have sex with men and you a man, it was in your genes. You beat on women, it was in your genes. Eugenics tries to blame your DNA for problems created by the power structure. And you can't have one without the other. So if you're going to say that black people are born gay, you're also going to have to start saying that they was born tremendous athletes, and they was born to sell dope, and they was born to go to jail. Y'all see that? Reject all notions that personality traits are inherited. They are not. They are a function of environment. Your skin color, yeah, that's inherited. Your eye color, that's inherited. Certain diseases, your propensity for heart disease, some of that stuff is inherited. Okay? But don't be buying into this nonsense that we inherit personality traits. Okay? And soy milk don't turn you gay, either. Some of y'all crazy out here. Soy milk has high levels of estrogen, which can bring about what? Effeminate traits in your boy. His breasts start hanging, voice can change. Are y'all following me? He can take on feminine traits physically, but soy milk doesn't make him want to have sex with men. Are y'all following me?
Right.
That's a personality variable. I'm about to get more gay people because of the soy milk. Yeah, that's just no homosexuality. All right, some of us are just too smart. We just need to shut up. Somebody sent me an email. Do you think maybe we got more homosexuals and lesbians because the stars is realigning? We about to go into the age of Aquarius. The feminine principles manifesting in the universe. The feminine principles is coming out. Some of us. Slow down. Too smart for your own good. Through subsequent placement in special ed and on dangerous stimulant and anti-stimulant medication, black boys are suffering irreversible side effects in a modern-day epidemic that can be properly called medication incarceration. And for my ladies who breastfeed, you got to stay away from the infant formulas.
Yeah.
The Isomil and the Similac. Guess who makes Similac? Abbott Laboratories. What else does Abbott Laboratories make? Okay? Depakote. The most powerful schizophrenic medicine on the market. So you mean to tell me you're giving your baby milk made by a psychiatric drug company? And you wonder why the baby keep crying for more? He ain't hungry, he high. Might as well stick a damn blunt in his mouth if you want to give him Similac. That's why we got so many overweight black infants now. Because you keep on feeding them the Similac. He's still crying. He must still be on his head. This damn bit you keep feeding. Look at their legs. They overweight infants. Look like the Michelin Man, black version. Like, why you keep feeding that baby? He crying. He ain't hungry. He high. He needs a detox. I'm being serious here. Why would you give an African child white man's milk? Because you got better things to do. My breast hurt. My mama didn't breastfeed. I ain't got to. I got to get back to work. Black children are suffering. We got better things to do. That's right. You want to do yourself a little experiment? Go home. Get a can of Similac out the cabinet. Or go to the store, buy a can of Similac, and then I want you to do research on each chemical in the ingredients. Some of the ingredients that they use in the baby breast formulas are used in industrial plants in the machines. And they're giving this to your children. Most of the ingredients in the breast formula are drugs, not food. Liquid crack is Similac. And it's time to wake up and smell the coffee. Through subsequent placement in special ed and on dangerous medicine, black boys are suffering the side effects. ADHD is a teacher's dream and a Wall Street miracle. A teacher's dream and a Wall Street miracle as it creates docile boys in the classroom and mega profits on Wall Street. Homosexuality. Where this came from? Greco-Roman culture. It's as old as white people is. As long as they've been around, homosexuality has been around. Am I saying all white people are homosexual? Nope. A lot of them can't stand no more than you can. But the culture is responsible for its production. That's where it comes from. It was introduced into Africa by European settlers and invaders. That is an absolute fact. Because Greco-Roman culture was an anti-woman culture. They hated the woman. She could do nothing for them. She was an agent of the devil. And so the white Greeks and Romans would only sleep with men because they felt the woman was too ungodly. Homosexuality has as its root a hatred for black women. That's the root cause. Begun in 1972 through the urgings of the population control junkies. I need y'all to understand this. Some of y'all don't understand why there's so much tenderizer in the black men today. In 1972, the Rockefeller World Population Council and Planned Parenthood International had a meeting on population control. At that meeting, they decided that we should deregulate homosexuality. Make the American Psychiatric Association take it out of the DSM. Homosexuality was a mental illness until 1973. It was a diagnosable condition until 1973. In 1973, at the American Psychiatric Convention, they voted to take homosexuality out of the DSM. And if you read the APH position paper on homosexuality, they tell you we did not remove it because we had proof that people were born gay. We removed it so homosexuals would be able to claim civil rights. They used the homosexuals to take over the black civil rights struggle. If you look at it, there's almost no discussion about black civil rights anymore. Everything is what? Gay rights. If a white kid calls your child the N-word, they get suspended. If your child calls a gay white kid a homosexual derogatory term, they'll get expelled. We have allowed the homosexual movement to hijack the black civil rights movement. And many of you have been co-opted into supporting. Because Obama and other enemies of the community are telling you that you're a minority, so are they. Time out. First of all, I'm not a minority. That's number one. That's your word, not mine. We got to stop letting people define us because it gets us in trouble. See, when you say I'm a minority, you put yourself in the same group of these Mexicans running around L.A. who are trying to take every institution you got. You put yourself in the same category with the Arabs running the stop and goes. The minute you accept minority, you have just grouped yourself in with anything that's non-white, even though they hate you as much as the white people.
Mm-hmm.
That was a mistake of the civil rights movement. Hindsight is 2020. We ain't condemning nobody. But we have to understand that in the movement for civil rights, because our leaders didn't want to fight by themselves, they reached out to Native Americans and Latinos and white women and homosexuals and Jews. We couldn't say that this was a black thing. We had to say that this was a minority color thing. And so after the civil rights movement was over, what happened? Everybody took from your pie that your ancestors died for, and you ain't got nothing from it. Go downtown to city council Monday and say, I want to see the percentage of blacks who got city contracts in L.A. You know what they might tell you? We don't keep statistics on black people who get contracts. We keep statistics on minorities. So guess what? Of the 50 contracts, 30 went to Mexicans, 10 went to Hispanics, 5% to the Arabs, 4% to the East Indians. And guess what? Not a single black person might have got a contract. But it looks like they did. Because you clumped yourself in with all the others. Do y'all see that?
Yes, sir.
Right.
So the first thing we got to do as we go forward is begin to be unapologetically African.
Yes.
You have to stop being guilty about standing up for just your group. We're the only people with that complex. Okay? We have a save the world complex. That ain't saved nobody, excuse me, just saved everybody but us. When the Jews come in the room, this is a Jewish thing. You're not allowed here. Arab, you're not allowed here. Chinese, they even put all the signs in Chinese so you know it ain't for you. Why you think you never see a black person working at a Chinese store because the help wanted signs is in Chinese? You can get a Rosetta Stone all you want, you still ain't gonna know what they hire. Black people, we want to fit in and be accepted. That's called low racial self-esteem. When I walk into a school, I want to know how many blacks are in special education. I want to know how many black men in jail. That's what I want to know. Well, we have, much respect to them, but they got people to fight. They fight. I'm fighting mine. Don't black and Latino, no. First of all, half the Latinos is Spanish-speaking Africans who don't want to be black. So I'm not going to accept you as something different when you know you're the same as I am, but because you don't want to acknowledge you're an African, you want to hide behind a Hispanic title. Well, you blacker than me, hair nappier than mine, more Ebonics than I got. Talking about I'm Latina, we all different. Y'all have a gay curriculum. Well, let me finish with the homosexuality. So 1973, APA took it out the book. 1974, what happened? For the first time in April of 1974, couple months, before I was born, I'm an August of 74 baby. April of 74 was the first time you got a DSM, diagnostic book, where homosexuality was taken out. It's only been 36 years. 38 years. So you got to ask yourself, how in 38 years has homosexuality, which was a small problem in the black community, we always had it since we've been with the white man, but it was small. How did it get so big, and how did it go all the way down to second, third, and fourth grade? Now you got fifth and sixth grade black boys talking about, I'm gay. Sixth or seventh and eighth grade black girls, I'm lesbian. You don't even know how to spell the word. Because the teachers in a public school, and I know this for a fact, are pushing it.
Okay.
Nearly every high school in America got a what? Gay and lesbian club.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. They got, and guess who's cheering it? One of the homosexual teachers.
Right.
And they run around recruiting students to learn more about alternative life.
Right.
and our kids not knowing what to do, what to believe in, because we too afraid to tell them that you are unapologetically heterosexual or gravitating to the clubs.
Right.
And then they get introduced to sexual experiences as their first sex act.
Right.
And normally when your first sex act is with the same gender, you tend to stay with that.
That's right.
It's called the primacy of the first experience, which is why you need to guard your babies from molesters in the black community, because we got a pedophile problem in the hood.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
I get phone calls all the time. That's right. That's right. Yeah, the Roman Catholic Church got a big problem, but the Baptist Church got one too.
Right.
Hallelujah.
Yeah.
And the Lord said, I shall. That's right. And then I'm getting a letter from somebody's mom talking about you flipping their son over after church practice. You all under their daughter's skirt at the choir practice. And I ain't no offense, because I respect all religions, but there's something about the choir.
Come on now.
And black men that do not get along. Brother, going to the choir, plant, pants sagging, tents on, do-rag. My mom said I gotta be in the choir. 6 weeks later, ooh. You're like, wait a minute, what they do to the brother? What type of Kool-Aid is in there? What's in the Kool-Aid? Because he was a strange heart. He had some problems, but now he saw. What did y'all do with the choir? Get my nephews over here, please. No choir and no Kool-Aid. We going home. Okay? But you have to recognize the effeminizing functions of institutions on black men when most of the population are female.
Mm.
Whether it's the school or the church.
Right.
See, in African society, there was times where boys could only be with men.
Right.
Because we had to make sure they were masculine.
Yes.
We had to make sure the testosterone levels was high. And by the way, for those of you who got your sons on kitty crack, did you know one of the side effects is a reduction in testosterone levels?
Yes.
Do you know what that means?
Huh.
That means the psychiatric brain drugs are effeminizing our son. Okay? So 1974, Secretary of State Henry Kissinger publishes a National Security Memorandum on Population Control. Y'all remember Henry Kissinger, he's a Rockefeller's person. Okay? He put out a document that you can download on the internet. It's about 400 pages, y'all need to. NSSM 200. Okay? NSSM 200. You want to download that. Put NSSM 200 full text. Put full text. Download it. You read it. What did he recommend? That we teach sex education in the classroom. This is 1974, 38 years ago. He also said what? That we might want to consider putting stuff in the water. Ladies, have you heard about the new cervical cancer shot, HPV shot they want to get at the black teenage girl?
Uh-huh.
You want to let them stick a needle in your daughter's cervix so she don't get cancer? Are you crazy? You don't let them do that. Where did AIDS come from? They manufactured AIDS to get rid of Africa. We know where they got it. United States Army Bioweapons Lab, Fort Detrick, Maryland. And half the cancers that black people suffer from was developed on the road to coming up with AIDS. Did you know that? Because AIDS is a type of a cancer. Bird flu, swine flu, all this stuff come right from Maryland. Bioweapons. What is bioweapons? You obviously targeted somebody by a different makeup. You targeting African people. Bird flu, swine flu. And do you know where they say AIDS come from? They say that a black woman in the Congo had sex with a monkey. That's the day they say. That's the origin of AIDS. But what they say is at the Center for Disease Control, they say that it come from a monkey in the Congo. And somehow it got to the woman. Read between the lines. If a black woman got AIDS from a monkey, how did she get the AIDS from the monkey? You're insinuating that she cohabitated with the primate. Did y'all see that?
Yeah.
And why the Congo? Because the Congo is the richest piece of real estate on the planet Earth.
Yes, it is.
To scare all you to never go there. That's where AIDS come from. So no black person go to the Congo so they can come in and steal all the diamonds and the minerals and the coltan. Because you know without the Congo, you don't get coltan. Coltan is needed for your cell phone, your automobile, television, any electromagnetic device, walkie-talkie, airplane, submarine. Without coltan, that don't work. So without the Congo, there's no white supremacy.
Right.
See, the interesting thing about white people is they love to tell black people to go back home if you don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
Always want to send somebody home.
Correct.
But here's the question. If we start sending everybody home, Where in the hell will you go? Because you ain't got one. Wherever you came from, you stole it from the Africans who was there before you, including Europe. So if you want to keep sending people home, we need to send you home. Y'all are the natural foster children of the world. California, the first state to approve mandatory gay curriculum. Y'all children get it as part of the social study. I hope y'all looking in your children's books, because I see books now where the cartoons in the kindergarten books got wife-wife families and husband-husband families. But y'all don't even know because you don't look at them. They're already out there. I've seen them. Parents have shown them to me, and I see them in the schools where I work at. This is what's happening. This is another reason why we have to build independent schools. We just can't build charter schools. Okay, charter schools are a good temporary strategy. It's not permanent. You know why? Because the state will come in and say, this is a publicly funded charter school, and you don't have no gay instructors. What you going to do? You're not teaching gay curriculum. Start teaching a gay curriculum and get a gay teacher, or we're going to shut you down. What are you going to do? You're going to bring that gay teacher in there because you're dependent on the money. That's why the Honorable Marcus Garvey said in his wisdom that black people should never accept money from white people. He said that white money in a black organization is a cancer that eats away at our ability to do for ourselves. But some of y'all belong to organizations with white people all in them. They the secretaries, liberal whites. What the hell is a liberal white? That's a white person who got black people thinking that they don't see no differences between them and them. And half the liberal whites that are working in your organization getting grant money in the name of your organization, and you don't even know it. That's right, they hustling you. I got an email last night from a sister. She said, Brother Umar, you keep talking about Africa, Africa, Africa. Well, most of the people in Africa helping the Africans ain't black people, it's white people. They the ones helping. I said, sweetheart, every white person in Africa claiming to help white people got a grant in a nonprofit 501c3, get $1 million funding for claiming to help the poor blacks. They're not over there for free. You think these white people opening up charter schools in L.A. to help black kids? Charter school means I can give myself a six-figure salary and not have to work for it a day of my life. If I come to L.A. and open a charter school, I'm going to make her the principal. I'm the CEO. Is she the principal? What do you need a CEO for? You don't. It's called free paycheck. This is what the white folks do. And then I can hire all my family. And then the politicians come and eat at my feet because all I got 500 kids. That's 1,000 parents. That's 1,000 votes. Charter schools are power. People don't start charter schools for education. They start charter schools to be able to influence the economic reality of that neighborhood. Y'all got to wake up and smell the coffee. Ain't no such thing as a benevolent white person. That's how Africa feels. Because the white people came in and we said, they are brothers and our sisters. I don't see color. I'm colorblind. Well, guess what? I'm not interested in going to war with any blind-ass black. Because in this world, you got to be able to see. So if you colorblind, stay away from me. What I'm going to do with a colorblind is, I don't see color. I can't see my kids. I don't see white people. Does that make any sense? My Lord don't see no color. Well, let me see your Lord. White Christ. Talk about I'm going to change my religion because the Lord don't answer me. You praying to Willie Lynch. Why would he answer? He's the God of the white, not the God of the black. You know where we get that white Jesus from, that homosexualized Christ picture. Okay? That comes from who? That comes from Leonardo da Vinci, 1482. Commissioned by the Pope to paint the Last Supper, y'all. Prior to that picture, there's no picture of a white Jesus nowhere anywhere. That's the first one. 10 years before Columbus set sail. Why? Coincidence? No. The white Christ in the Last Supper was the greatest weapon used against black people. If you don't believe me, go all up and down West Africa, and every black church I've seen in Africa still got a white Jesus in there. Blue black people with a white Christ. And you go in the black community, you see the same thing. We still got a white Christ, and the pastor talking about color don't matter. Well, if it didn't matter, why do you think the Europeans systematically destroy or change the complexion of every Christ in the world? And the rest of them, they lock them up in the basement. There's hundreds in the basement of the Vatican.
Okay, Morris, we're back. Area code 757, tell us who you are, what your question or comment.
My name is Jeffrey Hall, and I'm from Norfolk, Virginia.
Hey, Jeffrey, let me have it.
Hey, how you doing, sir? I had a question. My son and my daughter go to a school called Lindenwood Elementary, and they both take IV medication.
Mm-hmm.
And with the medication, both of them have side effects, meaning they grow. I know they should be growing more than what they are right now. And when they take the medication, they all of a sudden not hungry, but my kids like to eat. And they always put, like, when they eating, after they take the medication, now I see a behavior change, meaning they like a zombie. And I have my son in football, and by me having him in football, I need him alert. But when he takes the medication, he's all of a sudden not alert. He's like a second or 3 seconds late. And with the teachers and the mother of my kids, she automatically just go along with what the teachers are telling them instead of doing her own research. And now I see within my kids, they depend on the medication. I asked my kid one time, why are you acting up? Because I didn't take my medication. So I'm just trying to get, like, some help or some clues, and I'm also trying to see why is the teachers are not like the teachers back in the days that really care for the kids, because back in the days, the teachers didn't use their job as a paycheck, but now it's more of a paycheck than actually having love for the kids, because if you have love for the kids, you will automatically know that you should be 10 steps ahead of a child. Before they act.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what you do, Jeffrey. At the end of this broadcast, why don't you give me a call at 904-303-9061.
903. I was driving, sir, so I'm trying to grab a pen real quick so I can write that down, because I really would like to give you a call on that, because that's a strong...
Okay, well, let me just get it to you, because we come to the end of the broadcast. It's 904-303-9061. You got it.
Yeah, 9061. I got it.
All right. Thank you for calling, my brother. Ladies and gentlemen, we come to the end of the broadcast, and I think these shots can be heard all the way around the world. I suggest you play this broadcast over and over till you get this thing down for science. Make sure your children hear it. Play it for the whole family, and keep this treasure of information, because it's very, very important. For us to understand the problems and the solutions that have been presented here tonight. I've been your host, Tahaka Amana L. Bay, and until next time, you all have a good evening.
Yes.